Ahoy, mateys. Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, here with you on our 17th voyage into the gaming world. We're recording this on December 29th, 2012, but it's pretty late in the night, so we'll be wrapping up probably on December 30th. In any event, you'll be listening to it hopefully that first week of January, so I hope you've had a lovely celebration, celebrating the new year, ringing it in right. With me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Man, I'm really in the mood to pillage some booty.
Aren't you always?
Pretty much.
This week we're going to be talking about the Mega Man 25th anniversary. I can hardly believe it, but it's been a pretty awesome 25 years of jumping and shooting. We're also going to sort of revisit last week's discussion topic and sort of do a follow-up, an extended follow-up, finishing up our conversation about sort of the best that 2012 had to offer. So, starting the new year off with a slightly longer episode than usual, we're still going to try to keep it under the length of some of these gigantic audio orgies you might hear. And I think with that, it's time to start our follow-ups. Mr. Slagkick, if you'd like to take one.
So our first follow-up isn't too surprising, but we got a little clarification on the European Wii U eShop restrictions. It's due to a German law that prohibits the sale of so-called adult content. Not like sexy adult content, but, you know, mature games, as we call them over here. And so, yeah, it's basically to do with that German law. We kind of suspected as much. So,
yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week, I think.
Nothing else to really say about that. Just, you know, we still don't think that it's a huge deal, but of course we're also not in Europe, so sorry about it.
Let's see. Next up, the Square Enix countdown that we talked about last week. You may recall, everyone thought that it was for a new Star Ocean game. I say thought, I guess I should say hoped, because we all kind of thought it would be an iOS social game. It turns out it is neither of those things. It's actually a browser MMO. This is Star Galaxy, and we don't know too much about it yet, but it's going to be like a 2,000 simultaneous player, like single battlefield, like resource infrastructure, power source, like base building, like strategy game. I actually think this sounds kind of good, almost like sort of a sci-fi Civilization, if you know, it does play the way that that all sounds. And I gotta say, I'm here for that.
Yeah, I was expecting a social game. This sounds kind of compelling, so we'll have to see how it shapes up.
Yeah, I'm going to say, you know, conservatively excited. Like, I'm trying to keep myself restrained, but definitely looking forward to seeing what that's all about. Big news for me, personally, next up, we have the Kingdom Hearts 1.5 HD Remix. The Japanese release has been dated for March 14th, 2013. And I'm going to import it. but hopefully we'll hear something about a U.S. release by E3 this year. So, yeah, know, hopefully by June.
It would be really nice if it was a worldwide simultaneous release, but I think that's being way too hopeful. I'm just super eager to get my hands on this.
Yeah, I love HD remasters generally. And I very specifically love anything and everything Kingdom Hearts. So,
right.
You know, I'm going to import, and when it comes out in the U.S., fingers crossed, I will definitely buy it then again as well.
And for those listeners who are listening closely right now, you might have been like, wait, why would he be getting a PS3 game?
Why would you be getting a PS3 game, First Mate Slagkick?
If you follow our social media, you might have noticed that I picked up a new PS3. I'll be talking about that more a little later in our episode, but I have to agree with you. HD remasters are fucking rad. And, I mean, obviously, what can be better than Kingdom Hearts HD remasters. Remix.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, something somewhat interesting I was reading online, you know, just in the last week or two, that Square Enix, they have now confirmed that while there will not be a traditional secret movie in 1.5 HD Remix, there will be new content of some kind for players to discover after completing the game. So I'm waiting with bated breath. I'm hoping it ties into an announcement for maybe a 2.5 remix, but I'm not going to get my hopes up.
Oh, I mean, I think it's only inevitable. And
definitely.
The thing that I can't wait to see is that the Kingdom Hearts games were already gorgeous, and you know, even and I wouldn't say that some of these other games that we've seen the HD remasters like Ico, Shadow of the Colossus, the God of War series. Not that they weren't good-looking games, but I mean, you know, Square has always pushed boundaries. Maybe not pushed boundaries, but pushed the limits of the hardware that they've developed for. So, I mean, Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2 were already beautiful games. So I'm certain that this is just going to be absolutely gorgeous. Because, I mean, considering that some of these games that don't quite push the limits, in terms of graphics.
Well, the one that comes to mind to tie into what you're saying right now is the Ratchet and Clank HD remaster looks gorgeous.
Yeah, and I mean, not that Ratchet and Clank was a fugly game, but it certainly wasn't at the level of Kingdom Hearts.
No, but so it saying, cleaned up real
if
well.
If these slightly lesser impressive games graphically, they already look super good in HD. With these HD remasters, I'm so excited that I can't really formulate words.
I think what you're saying is that if some of these games that didn't look quite as good as Kingdom Hearts did in their original iterations clean up that well, that an HD remaster of Kingdom Hearts is going to be something to really behold.
It's going to be pretty sexual, let's be real.
I don't know about all that.
Except that it's a Disney game, so Disney and sexy don't really mix most of the time.
Why, Gooby?
Oh.
Anyway, moving on. Next talking point, and this is one that sort of touches on basically everything we've discussed over the last year. MMO The Secret World, which we here at Game Buoy wholeheartedly endorse, is...
Very cool game.
...officially abandoning its subscription model.
I feel kind of bad because I think I even said on our MMO episode that I was kind of anticipating that happening.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't think it was going to happen this quickly, but...
I think we all expected this to happen. But the good news is the game is still a product that you purchase in the store. It's more of like the...
Guild Wars 2.
Exactly. It is the Guild Wars model of you purchase the game... And then online play is included in that purchase.
And that's great, because, you know, more people can access this game that maybe would have been put off on it before because of the subscription fee. That's great, because they're really doing something a little different.
Yeah, and, you know, they already in the game had a cash shop. I'm sure they'll just add more content to the cash shop.
That's true, and yeah.
I don't really feel like anyone loses here. It's not quite like the Knights of the Republic, Old Republic, I'm sorry, the Old Republic. It's not like the Old Republic scenario where...
Yeah, the cartel coins and...
You're removing content from the game and gating things super heavily so that the free-to-play players are effectively getting a super gimped game and almost an unpleasant experience... My understanding is that this is a lot more like, oh yeah, if you buy this game, play it, have hella fun, and then just give us more money in the cash shop. And I think that works out really well. I think that's good. I think it's going to work out well for them, and hopefully more people are going to get to experience this incredible game.
You know, I haven't spent too much time with it, you know, so I'm probably guilty of being partially responsible for why it went, you know... I don't want to say free-to-play, but why they took away the subscription cost, because I didn't spend too much time playing it after I got it. But I liked what I played, and I would, if it was reasonably priced, I would buy some cool clothes for my caster girl. You know, I would be down for that. As long as it wasn't, like, some crazy $80 bullshit like that Eve tries to pull. Was that, yeah. That was Eve, right? That had, like, the $72 goggles for your avatar that doesn't really do quite anything yet.
It was, but that's not even a conversation that we should be having. Frankly, if you're not a part of the Eve ecosystem, I don't think you can quite understand or discuss how special that game and that community are. I have literally, in the 31 years of my life, never seen anything remotely like the environment, the social climate, like just everything about that game is bizarre, incredible, and unique. Unique being the key point. But no, I remember in Secret World when I was playing very heavily, I purchased a duster coat. It was a couple of bucks or something. I don't know. I think I might have had like a free money from buying a collector's edition or something. And it was a really cool coat. Like, people in game would ask, like, "Oh, where did you get that?" And I'd be like, "LOL, Cash Shop." So it's like you say, it's cool looking stuff. It's not just like a pair of goggles. Yeah, like some of these items look really rad.
Yeah, you know, I really want to give this game another chance. I never wrote it off. Specifically, I just kind of didn't play it. And part of it might have been that my laptop couldn't quite run it super well, at least to the level I would like it to. So, you know, maybe I'll see about building a PC or getting a Steam box, one of those things.
You get real picky about game performance, I've noticed. So I guess I'm not that surprised.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I've talked about it a lot, but I do my PC gaming on a Sony laptop, and it's capable, but it's not, you know, like top of the line. So yeah. I'm not a snob, but I like to have at least smooth frame rates. But that's a conversation for another day, I think.
Well, I guess we are sort of getting to a point now of sort of sadder news, what with the Secret World subscription situation. And now we have Code Hero. You might be familiar with the Kickstarter Code Hero. It was supposed to be a really cool game, somewhat inspired by Guitar Hero and what have you, that was meant to teach players, and in particular kids in school, teach them how to code in a gamified setting of sort of having, you know, goals and rewards and a little narrative. And unfortunately, since this Kickstarter, this successful Kickstarter, wrapped up several months ago, I guess, in fact, I say several months ago, but I'm looking over my notes here. It looks like this was quite some time, like back in like March, it almost looks like. Oh my gosh. So, there's been very little movement on this. They've updated the Kickstarter page, claiming that betas would be posted, that alphas would be posted, that they would be, you know, communicating with people whom were getting physical rewards promised to them. And I guess that they're just missing each and every one of these deadlines that they set for themselves. And further, I guess this gentleman who ran this Kickstarter, I guess he previously had a venture of a clothing line for like badass chicks. That is not my description. I apologize if the term badass chicks offends you. Although also you should just, you know, own being badass, yo. I guess that this clothing line was called Tactical Corsets, and their Facebook page is basically full of comments from people who gave this guy money, and then he never delivered these clothes or corsets or whatever. So, this sucks balls, and it's basically everything we were worried about when we discussed Kickstarter much earlier this year. It's basically all of it come true.
And, you know, I'm not going to say that this guy's trying to run a scam, but it's just really unfortunate. I mean, I think anything encouraging kids, or not just kids, but, you know, kids, adults, anybody, to learn to code is cool. It makes me kind of think of there's a website called Code Academy, which is similar. It's more of like a social network sort of thing that like you can like kind of get badges and such. So I mean,
that's rad.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I've done a couple JavaScript courses on there and such. It's really cool. But the point being that, you know, this Code Hero thing sounded like it would be pretty cool, especially like, you know, like we've said, a gamifying things can really be good motivation. So,
well, yeah, look at the success Fitocracy has had for people trying to lose weight.
Yeah, yeah.
So I definitely think that there's merit in tying gamification and points and, you know, goals and sort of tying that to real world sort of trouble areas and learning experiences where people maybe need a little encouraging push in the right direction.
Indeed. So, you know, this is what will happen from this still remains to be seen, but it just sucks for this guy, you know. It just, yeah.
If you want to read more about this, I highly recommend that you check out the link. We're going to post it on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And it's really just a major bummer, but it's a long story. I definitely encourage you to check this one out and sort of educate yourself. And, you know, again, it really just goes to show you that when it comes to Kickstarter, things are a little bit buyer beware. You know, unfortunately, it's like the Wild West frontier out there. In related news, however, one Kickstarter that a lot of people thought was going to flop super hard, the Ouya has had its first unboxing video hit the web.
On Kotaku, of course, because, you know, that's like a front page story for them, just posting videos. Yeah, the developer consoles just went out. So it's looking like this will hit its timeline. And, you know, we're not sure how many of you out there pledged on the Ouya Kickstarter. A couple of you probably.
Yeah, I definitely. We
I don't
have
think
a few
we have
people.
Any developer Ouya pledgers out there, but maybe, if you though. Happen to be one, we know a couple people who listen who develop games, so if you happen to be a Ouya supporter who got a developer console, we'd like to hear from you.
Yeah, I would love to hear more about it. I'm reading that per the Ouya folks, the operating system's still pretty buggy, and the controllers don't interface right all the time, but, you know, it also has to be said, these are normal kinks for new hardware, so I'm not too worried about it. But I still would really like to hear a hands-on, unfiltered perspective. So if there's any way you could provide us with that, please do touch base with us on our Twitter. That's at GameBuoy.org. Spelled out, though, so it's GameBuoy, D-O-T-O-R-G.
GameBuoy, D-O-T-O-R-G.
And we actually have another Kickstarter-related thing to talk about. But first, I just want to talk about something very near and dear to my heart. I want to touch on the THQ situation.
Yeah, let's give an update on that.
So, since our last episode, I constantly call it last week, but I guess it's really been more like 2 or 3 weeks ago. While all of the THQ employees were on holiday vacation, they entered into bankruptcy protection. It's sort of impossible to know right this very moment if this is really a good or bad thing right now. But we do know that this is Chapter 11 bankruptcy. You might be familiar with Chapter 11 as a concept from when Marvel Comics filed for Chapter 11 back at the end of the 1996 fiscal year. Of course, that worked out for them. Chapter 11 is where you're basically given room from your debt payments to sort of restructure, field offers for purchase from third parties, which my understanding is that THQ does have an interested third party looking into buying them. So this is Chapter 11. It's not Chapter 7, which 7 would be bad. That would be the one where their doors are basically closed and they're dead. So this is a real tricky, and I apologize, I'm very sort of, if not upset, then concerned about this circumstance. I'm really hoping that this works out. My heart goes out to all of these employees who probably read about this on Kotaku or Gaff or something while they were on their holiday break. So let's hope they have a plan. Let's hope there's a plan. Let's hope that this buyout happens correctly, that all of the THQ employees and intellectual properties can stay under one roof, and that we can have another great year or two or three of Saints Row and Darksiders. Yeah. And I don't know if they still have the UFC license, but if they do, then that too.
I think that might have been one of the ones they lost.
Well, whatever. I mean, Saints Row and Darksiders.
Lost, they had to give up.
Either way, Saints Row and Darksiders are both awesome. Saints Row and Darksiders
are... I would be happy to see more of that. I am so here for that.
Let's hope that this works out. Fingers crossed. Game Buoy absolutely loves each and every one of you guys over at THQ. And just know our thoughts and prayers are with you guys, and hopefully this works out.
Well said.
And now, back to that Kickstarter tip. You may remember, in fact, I dare say it would be impossible for you to have forgotten, that we here on Game Buoy are super gay. Accordingly, we've been very excited about GamerCon. That is, of course, the gaming convention for gay gamers. And their allies. Absolutely important note. And we've talked quite a bit about their Kickstarter, which was fortunately quite successful.
Indeed.
We also talked about potential copyright disputes that might happen with a gentleman named Chris Vizzini, who owns the copyright to the term gamer.
The guy who might have herpes.
I don't believe he has herpes. The official Game Buoy podcast stance on Chris Vizzini is that he does not have herpes anymore than is statistically likely for someone in his social circumstances. So the reason we bring this up is that GamerCon is now GamerX. And Slagkick here did some reporting of some kind that I think he wants to tell you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we're going to link you to an article from Forbes.com, which is really well written and explains this, but the first site that I saw reporting on it was Kotaku, of course, because they have to get the page hits. And not surprisingly, they misreported it. They just automatically assumed that it was an issue with Chris Vizzini.
Now, to be fair, I jumped to that same conclusion. But I also don't get paid to think about this stuff, so I'm not too worried about it.
Yeah, right? I mean, not that it's like a... it's not like it came out of nowhere,
Been sort of a possibility for all year ever since Mr. Vizzini, who maybe doesn't have herpes, was slapping people down for using the term gamer.
Right, right. The interesting thing is that this has nothing to do with Chris Vizzini, who may or may not have herpes. It actually has to do with something that I've never heard of before, which kind of makes me not like them for being picky or whatever, but you know, there's legal stuff. I'm not going to get.
Yeah, of course. Into of it, course.
But it's called GamerCon, but the E in gamer is a 3. So it's kind of like elite speak or whatever. So Game 3 or con,
but it's pronounced GamerCon. It's pronounced so GamerCon, it's phonetically the same.
And they apparently own the trademarks to like all phonetic derivations of GamerCon. And that unfortunately includes GamerCon, the con that we've been promoting here on Game Buoy. So, you know, originally the GamerCon folks, now GamerX, they had thought that they might be able to do some sort of shared use sort of thing, but now it's looking like Game 3-er con.
Now, did we, in our excitement over this issue, did we even clearly state that GamerCon is now GamerX?
Yes.
Delightful. I wasn't quite sure. And, you know, I'm looking at, you know, sort of looking into this issue, and I'm looking over my notes, and I just can't help but see the picture of Game Buoy heartthrob Matt Kahn and get a little distracted.
Right? Anyway, so it's unfortunate that you know, that this happened, but they've, I think, really they've pushed forward. They've done, I would say, a pretty flawless job transitioning to this new name. And it's, I'd also like to give a little shout out to Gamer Connect, which they have launched.
Yeah, yeah, same gentleman, Matt Kahn, I guess.
Yeah, also there's also a whole team that's working really hard.
Yes,
doing great things.
But are they GameBuoy heartthrobs?
I haven't seen their pictures, but
okay, Gamer Connect folks, post your pictures so that First Mate Slagkick and I can judge you based on your looks.
But yes, Matt Kahn and his crew have launched Gamer Connect, and it's some kind of similar to what we were talking about with the whole gamification of things. And the Forbes article actually goes into this a little bit, which we will link to you on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
It's really cool. I mean, it's still a work in progress, and they, you know, they openly acknowledge that, so, I mean, nothing wrong with that. But
it's a social... So I understand you gain points, and you get level ups for interacting with other gay gamers and sort of meeting up with folks and maybe playing together in guilds or something. I'm a little fuzzy on the details.
And, I mean, I think it's something that's really evolving, too, which is cool.
That's great, yeah.
But, I mean, I think just the fact that it's a place for gay gamers to connect with other gay gamers, I mean, we don't want to belabor the point, but I think it's important to point out, even if it's an obvious point, typically whenever you see an article about, in this past year when we've seen articles about GamerCon, now GamerX, that there inevitably will be a comment from someone being like, well, why do gays need their own event?
You know, the honest answer is, gays need their own event because you still feel the need to question why the gays need their own event.
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't have said it any better myself. And, you know, just the very fact that as gay gamers, I mean, this is why it's something so personal that we can relate to. You know, I mean, both of us growing up as gay gamers, it was never easy trying to meet other gay gamers. I think, honestly, for me, Captain Spike was probably one of the first gay gamers that I met. And I was like, wow, there's other gay dudes who are into his video games as much as I was. And I thought, you know, back in the early 2000s, that was just like a crazy thing.
Let the record state that when I met First Mate Slagkick, I was way more into games than he was. So, not just he met someone as into games as him, he met someone way more into games than him.
I think very few people have the passion for games that you do, Captain Spike.
Why, thank
Point
you.
Point being that not only is it important in sort of a larger discussion about, you know, the gay community at large having a voice in, you know, because, I mean, that's something that comes up with gay pride and other sorts of events. Why do we need it? But, you know, I think just for the very simple fact that, you know, just connecting, meeting other gay gamers. And, of course, you're always going to have a troll being like, oh, well, it's going to be a giant orgy, but, you know, no.
That's such a bad thing.
Yeah, that's what the hotel rooms are for.
No, but seriously, it's
all
not...
All seriousness?
It's not going to be an orgy, and if it was, I wouldn't go. But I'm certain that it's not going to... Oh, I'm sure you are. You would. You're single. Go for it, bro. Have fun. But in all seriousness, it's not going to be that. It's going to be really cool. People are going to network. I'm going to give out hell of GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Business cards. It's going to be amazing. We're going to meet a bunch of cool people. We're going to start gaming with people in Halo who are not going to call anybody faggot. It's going to be amazing. And, you know, further from that, I want to reiterate, I know I talked about this some number of weeks ago, by which I suppose I mean months ago, but it was really difficult. When I first came out as a gay man and sort of hit the dating scene, it was a bad, like, it was definitely viewed as a negative thing that I was, like, a super hardcore gamer, that people would talk to me about, oh, I was in San Francisco the other night clubbing, and I was like, oh, I was in San Francisco, too. My favorite game import shop is in Japantown. Unfortunately, they're no longer there, but... You probably know where I'm talking about if you were a part of that scene.
Did you pour a 40 on the street? in memory of them, yeah.
And just having to explain, like, oh, yeah, you know, I studied Japanese language for several years so that I could play Japanese role-playing games, and I mod systems and take them apart and resolder shit, and, like, this is all just way too much for dudes, gay dudes in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it was awful. So I love the idea, you know, I'm unfortunately with a wonderful man now, but I'm very, very pleased and very happy that gay gamers now will sort of are certainly developing this really great community and having these really great opportunities for connection. And I'm so excited for this. And anytime I hear someone ask, why do the gays need their own event? It's like, you don't understand because you don't have the problems associated with this social circumstance. And I'm happy for you that you don't. But this is a thing that needs to happen. And frankly, I just once again want to say thank you so much to the GamerCon, GamerX folks.
GamerConnect,
certainly.
Seriously, even like we said, GamerX and GamerConnect are for allies too. So even if you're not into same-sex romantic interludes, you can still totally join in the community, you know.
Hey, bro, it's getting pretty gay in here.
It is.
I think it's time for
news. 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 Oh my god, news. Hey, dude, I wasn't exactly quite done talking about GamerX and GamerConnect.
Excuse me, princess. All right, I'll give you another minute, but I don't want to alienate anyone. If y'all are offended by gay shit, you're listening to the wrong podcast.
Pretty much.
But I ain't trying to preach. But wrap it up.
No, you know, I just wanted to say that I think both in terms of a larger aspect of the gay community at large and our own little subset as the gay gamers, we really personally are very passionate about this cause. And so,
oh yeah, we're super passionate about this. And you know, I tease First Mate Slagkick for having so much to say on this topic, but I really think it's a projection of my own insecurity about how excited I am for this event and this website and this entire movement, frankly. So again, thank you so much, guys, for putting this together. All of you allies, thank you for being allies. And please, by all means, come out and hang out and party with us. We ain't going to have a hotel party room, but, you know, I'm sure we'll be there partying and dancing somewhere. That having been said, let's get down to some news.
Theater Rhythm. Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy, which isn't actually that difficult to say, so I don't know why I totally flubbed it. Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy. That's kind of a tongue twister if you say it a couple times fast.
Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy. Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy.
let's stop doing that. The people are probably getting frustrated now. Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy is now on the iOS App Store.
Oh, yeah?
And the thing is that it's pretty much just like a base game. I don't even know, does it even come with any songs at all? Maybe just like a handful?
You know, it comes with two songs. The first of which escapes me, but the second is actually One Winged Angel.
Okay, typical.
Which, I'm not a huge Final Fantasy VII fan, as
we've discussed. If you're trying to hook gamers into this by having one song,
that's the motherfucking song you use.
Right?
So,
although
good
for me,
on
it would be that Latin song from the introduction to Final Fantasy VIII that Matt said. So the idea being that, of course, you buy additional songs on the App Store. The thing is, when you add up all of these in-app purchases, it is a horrifying price.
Yeah, well, you know, I was looking, and I think it's really rad. You know, this iOS version has content not in the 3DS version originally released. It has new characters, including Balthier from Final Fantasy XII.
Holla!
Right? It has, you know, a ton of new music, including songs that were DLC for the 3DS version, such as the Type-Zero theme. Although, surprisingly, not the song from Final Fantasy Versus 13 mm-hmm. that was available for 3DS. But when you add all of these purchases up, you come out to around $150.
And we just need to compare that to the 3DS version,
which can be had for about $29.99,
yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's rad that they're doing this whole a la carte thing. I guess if you don't like any of the music from Final Fantasy V, you fail. But, you know, then you don't have to play those songs, and I guess that's cool. But they also removed all of the really cool FMV-based event songs. And that, to me, is sort of a bigger hit because I really liked those songs, and I liked having that third play style in the game in addition to the battle songs and the field songs. So I definitely think that it's great that Square Enix is trying new things. I've spoken before about how, you know, they're really trying to find their footing on the iOS App Store, trying different things for how to sell their content. But ultimately, for me, this is a miss.
Let's just say that we're not trying to be Kotaku and complaining about the price. But I'm sorry, as much as I like Final Fantasy, as much as I like Square Enix, I'd rather just go out and buy the 3DS version. I'm sorry. I'm not going to... And, you know, who knows? Maybe if there's some exclusive songs that are only on iOS, maybe I'll get the free app and just download the songs, but...
Yeah, you know, I have the app, and I like it. The game plays well on my iPhone, certainly. But I'm not... This is no replacement for my 3DS cartridge of the same game. I am not about to spend hella money just to have the same experience, much less to shell out more to have new content.
You know, one potential good use for it, and you could even just get the free version, would be to, like, show people, like, hey, check out this fucking rad game.
Oh, yeah, but be sure to get the 3DS version, because it's way cheaper.
So, like, almost as, like, more of a demo, and then if you really are into it, you can buy the 3DS version. Or, you know, maybe you are one of the two people out there who do not have a 3DS. You need to go get a 3DS right now.
Get a 3DS, dog.
Even if it's not an XL, if that's not your thing.
Even if it's not an XL. Listen to this, bitch.
Hey, I just got a new XL, and I love it.
Must be nice.
Anyway, this is one App Store, iOS, Square Enix price QQ that we'll have to sadly agree on.
Yep, so we're with you on this one, Kotaku.
This was actually Joystick.
Expensive game is expensive. Okay, Joystick, I'm sure Kotaku complained about the price, too. Let's be real.
Maybe they're too busy posting videos of Portal cakes.
Rude. So next up...
But it's so delicious and moist.
Next up, we have the announcement of Project Versus J. This is a Japanese fighting game. It's a crossover of all of the Jump / Weekly Jump / insert random noun, verb, or adjective Jump.
I honestly didn't realize there was more than Shonen Jump. I'm totally guilty.
Yeah, there's quite a few different Jump publications.
Is there Jump Jump? Crisscross makes you wanna?
I don't believe there is, but I really, really wish that was a thing. But, you know, it's a fighting game. The real interesting part of this is that it's for PlayStation 3 and Vita.
Oh, cool. So it's something that you can import then when it comes out.
Exactly, and I certainly will import it. But a lot of people were expecting it to be like Jump Ultimate Stars or Jump Superstars, which were
pretty,
both...
pretty neat little games.
Really great. Yeah, DS games. Gambarian made those games. Nintendo published them. And they're just super good, really complex, some really unique gameplay styles. This actually, based on the few screenshots that we have, featuring Monkey D. Luffy from One Piece, Son Goku from Dragon Ball Z, and Toriko from Toriko, it looks like it's going to follow along the lines of CyberConnect 2's Narultimate Hero series of
which,
Naruto
games. Which,
as we've
mentioned, is a really weird name for a game.
Yeah, I think we did have a good laugh about that a few weeks ago. So, Shonen Jump magazine has been running a poll for the last week or two now, asking players what characters they hope to see in this game, with the pre-selected options, as in, you know, like the non-write-in slots being dedicated to characters like Naruto, the kid from Hunter x Hunter, Gintama, Ichigo from Bleach, the girl whose name I always forget from Dr. Slump was listed. So I think this is going to be a pretty comprehensive game. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm a huge One Piece fan. I'm a huge Dragon Ball Z fan. I'm a huge Naruto fan.
I never thought I'd hear the day that you would consider yourself a huge One Piece fan.
You say that, but for many years I have had a small plastic statue of Roronoa Zoro in front of my TV. So let's not pretend there isn't precedent for me loving One Piece. So anyway, yeah, really excited for this game. Even if it does just end up to be another one of those awful cinematic fighters that for me are not really don't really do much, I'm still gonna play. I'm still looking forward to it.
It'll probably look cool. Probably look good.
Yeah. It in fact it already kind of does. So you know that's something.
You know, we haven't seen it in action yet, but it should be cool.
Yeah, we'll have links to these screenshots on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And if you're interested in the Shonen Jump properties, I definitely recommend you check that out.
For sure. So over on one of Captain Spike's favorite sites, Silicon Era. I'm sorry, Silicon Era, because that's how normal people say that.
Rude and hateful.
Actually, the Project vs. J was over on Silicon Era as well. This actually might be a little more of a follow-up, because we've talked about Dragon Quest X before on Game Buoy. It has been really successful in Japan, to the point of already exceeding the cost of its development.
That is my understanding, yes.
And pretty much Yuichi Wada-san from Square Enix, president of Square Enix, was talking about, you know, when Final Fantasy XI came out, people kind of doubted it, but it is the most profitable game in the Final Fantasy series because of its subscription fee, and you know, so they've already recovered their from what I understand, they've already recovered their development costs, and you know, they'll just continue to be profiting from that. And I am just sad that we probably won't see it in America, because it looks super rad. And
well, you know, just to give perspective on the success of Dragon Quest X, I want to point out, as Silicon Era states here, as of October, Dragon Quest X has over 400,000 paying monthly subscribers. Obviously, it achieved that having only come out in the end of August.
Yeah.
In comparison, and only in, you know, the Japan region, in comparison, it took Final Fantasy XI 18 months in all world markets to reach 400,000 subscribers.
So when you say the Japan region, you mean Japan.
Well, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, I say that, but, you know, there are certain areas of China where you get, and Hong Kong, where you get what's called the Asian release. And I don't know for online games if Asian release areas count as Japan or not.
See, I was just being a bitch, but you actually have some legitimate reason for saying Japan region.
Yeah, that's something that anyone out there that's listening to this that imports, y'all know what I'm talking about with Asian region games. So, you know, I don't know if that's counted as Japan or not.
I was just being a bitch.
Yes,
as usual.
So I slapped you down. So, in any event, you mentioned that you were very disappointed that this game wasn't coming to the U.S.
And as far as we know.
Well, I was just going to say, I have hopes that they will see the potential to make money off of this game in the U.S. with a digital release. I think this is the perfect example of a game where you take advantage of the fact that the Wii U can use any old USB hard drive that you plug into it and just sell this game as a digital download only off the eShop And, you know,
I would do it in a heartbeat.
In a heartbeat, me too. I'd absolutely buy this game off the eShop and play it, and I'd subscribe. I love Dragon Quest. Give me the opportunity to give you money, and I'm on board. So,
yeah, especially if they could do it digital on the cheap. You know, not on the cheap, but...
Cheap.
I love cheaps. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that Dragon Quest games, I don't believe that they sell Final Fantasy numbers over here, but...
Yeah, well, it's well known that the Nintendo-published Dragon Quest IX for DS, you know, it broke over 4 million in Japan, but in the US and EU regions, it still did a number in the millions. So...
That's no small feat.
It's no small feat for a JRPG in, you know, 2009 that came out. So you could do a hell of a lot worse than that. I think that they could get high enough numbers for Dragon Quest X to make it worth localizing. So keep your fingers crossed, and, you know, hopefully we'll see that at E3 this year. I'm hoping.
For sure. So, you know, I honestly can't recall in the heat of the moment... if we've discussed Disney Infinity before, you've probably read about it. If not, I don't.
By now, certainly, but I don't think we've talked about it previously.
Disney Infinity, you might have heard of it at first. A couple sites were reporting that they had press invites. Over at Polygon, they had access to a huge leak about it, and it's looking like it'll be something pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks really remarkable. I'm sorry, continue.
I think the official reveal happens next month, so by this point, you know, maybe a couple weeks from now. But basically, how were they describing it? They were saying that it was kind of like...
Yeah, the full reveal is set for January 15th, according to an invitation that went out in mid-December. Disney Interactive President John Pleasance and Disney Pixar CCO John Lasseter are going to be presenting at the event.
What, John Lasseter?
Obviously, these guys are big deals, so this is not just going to be some, you know, cat-in-the-box rinky-dink announcement. I don't really know what contextually cat-in-the-box means. I've never heard that meant for a small announcement, so...
Except that your kitten looks really damn cute in the box.
Yeah, she's hella cute in the box.
But
yeah, you know, this leak that Polygon has, it really indicates that this is a full game based on the truly phenomenal Toy Story 3 toy box mode, where you basically just get to play with assets and make little mini games of your own devising and shit.
Yeah, and I had to go refer back to the article, which you can see for yourself on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
I remembered that they compared it to, like, crazy over-the-top action of Just Cause, which, fuck yeah, but also Minecraft was what I was trying to think of. I'm not a huge Minecraft fan, but, hey, cool, creation, and actually a lot of kids I know. I just have to preface that I work with students, so I'm not just hanging around with kids being super creepy. I know a lot of kids... who are super into Minecraft. So, I mean, I think that it's a super smart thing for them to tap into. It's going to be an open-world sandbox. And, you know, they've shown some... they've shown it on an iPad, Android phone, and 360, but...
Well, again, the leak, the person leaking this to Polygon showed it to Polygon. Disney themselves have not shown this to anyone
right. And this... If this was a person from Disney, they might be fired by now.
Well, that was certainly, contextually, that was certainly the implication that I took away from that really just superb article on Polygon.
Yeah, Brian we're going to leak it. Because come a long way from Kotaku, hasn't he?
He sure has. But, you know, credit where it's due. It looks like he's making it work, so good on ya.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting because... The early rumors for the game suggested that it might be like a Skylanders sort of thing, which kind of makes sense, but it seems more like it's going to be more like a Minecraft slash Just Cause, which is kind of ambitious.
Build your own world and then play in it. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it remains to be seen. It could end up being a bit lackluster, as sometimes...
Anything can be a bit lackluster, though. Yeah, let's not pretend it's just licensed properties anymore.
But, you know,
this isn't 1991 anymore.
Yeah, but sometimes Disney products in the video game environment don't live up to expectations. See Epic Mickey franchise.
And sometimes they meet and exceed all possible expectations. See Kingdom Hearts Birth by Sleep.
Or any Kingdom Hearts game.
Well, you know, maybe except Recoded. Or 358 over 2.
Anyway, this looks pretty cool. I don't even give a shit if it's meant for children. I mean, I think the whole thing with Disney anyway. And we ain't trying to turn this into a Disney podcast. But Captain Spike and I are both big Disney fans. Like, lifelong Disney fans. Probably as big of Disney fans as we are video game fans.
Getting...
So I'm just saying that... You know, I don't even give a shit if this is meant for children. I'm totally going to play it. And, I mean, I'm going to give it a fair chance for sure. It looks really neat. And,
getting back on track with our news here.
Yeah, hey.
Listen. What's up?
And I was just going to say that, you know, I think that the whole idea of, like, creating within a game environment... You know, of course, probably the big thing you would think of is Little Big Planet, even if you're not a huge fan of that. Captain Spike's not a big fan.
Not what I would think.
But, you know, I mean, I dig the idea of video games that allow some level of user-created content. And, you know, this is all about user-created content. So I'm all for that, for sure.
Are you done, then?
I am done. You may finish off.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because, you know, last and, well, least. It's least. The latest game in the Earth Defense Force franchise has been announced for U.S. release.
Okay.
Earth Defense Force 4. Is being localized for North America and Europe as Earth Defense Force 2025 for release in 2013.
Why didn't they call it Earth Defense Force 2013?
Because it takes place in the year 2025, where you're fighting giant alien space ants.
Okay. That actually kind of sounds a little cool.
Yeah, it's a cool... I mean, you know, it's a D3 game, so... You kind of get what you pay for with those guys. But it's not awful. I like the franchise. I'll pick this up. But it's you probably wouldn't like it.
Okay.
Anyway, moving on. There's a certain Blue Bomber we're here to talk about tonight. And I'm ready to get to it. Mr. Slagkick, are you ready to talk about this?
I'm ready.
Would you say your body is ready?
I don't know if my body is ready. Is my body ready for Mega Man?
Mega. Just think about him from Captain N. I'm sure that'll do it for you.
That just makes it much worse.
So we're going to start off here, as we tend to do when we do these series retrospectives. We're going to talk about the main games in the franchise, give you sort of our thoughts on various aspects of these titles, some anecdotes, the things we love, the things we hate. But unlike the easiest example which comes to mind, which was our Final Fantasy episode some number of months back, there is just too much mainline Mega Man to discuss. So we're going to go over the games in the series and the franchise and the various series that are just generally regarded by the fandom and the fans and gamers in general to be sort of the canon. So without further ado, Mega Man. 25 years of Capcom's OG mascot.
Oh, doesn't that just bring back memories?
Show does. Different memories for me than it does for you. My understanding is that you played this game somewhat recently, so let's start it off for you. Mr. Slagkick, what are your thoughts on the first Mega Man?
I mean, I just have to preface this with, I have to say that when I was a youngster, you know, when Mega Man came out, I would have been about 3 years old, so I didn't pick up on the series right away. I remember as a kid playing Mega Man, but I was a kid, and I thought it was pretty fucking hard, so I don't remember really getting too far. I never owned any of the games. I maybe remember playing a couple of them at, you know, friends' houses, so I am pretty new to the franchise. But that said, you know, I thought to start celebrating our favorite Blue Bomber's birthday, Big 25, why not go back to where it started? And I actually decided to go with the re-release for PSP.
Powered
remake,
Up.
Powered Up. And, of course, this it's a lot more toned down. They added a couple new two new Robot Masters. But, I mean, I think it really highlights that, you know, because that port... I wouldn't even call it a port, a remake. That remake,
it's a remake. It is a absolute ground-up remake.
It's not a port. That remake is pretty well done. It's a little cutesy, maybe a little too cutesy than what Mega Man should be. But that said, really well done, you know, looks great, controls really well. But I think it just really speaks to... Even though, you know, Mega Man 1 may not be the most highly regarded of the titles, just how well it still stands up, how well designed it was, you know, that could still stand up, that would have been about maybe just 20 years after the first Mega Man, because that was about, what, 5 years ago that came out at this point.
What's really remarkable to me about the first Mega Man is that Capcom... You know, they came to the table, they had this sort of concept and design in place. You're this little blue dude, you're going to attack these other evil robots, you're going to steal their weapons. There's sort of a rock-paper-scissors mechanic insofar as if you use the water dude's weapon against the fire dude, then the fire dude's going to go down easier. Capcom came up
with
this...
Hence the name Rockman.
Oh, yes. Well, it's... Yeah, you know, yeah. We'll get into sort of the musical naming of Rockman, which is what Mega Man is called in Japan, since we didn't explicitly say that.
But
probably know
if,
that if you're listening
if you're
to Game
a Mega
Bowie.
Stan, you probably already knew that.
But, you know, again, we want to be comprehensive. What's really striking to me looking at the first Mega Man is that concept and those designs, like, that is still how this game series is being made. And it's still so compelling. You know, it was a big deal when just this month Street Fighter versus Mega Man came out. Or, I'm sorry, Street Fighter Cross Mega Man came out. And that whole game design is still in place. And it still works. It's still compelling. Even when, as in the case of Street Fighter Cross Mega Man... The level designs have some issues because, you know, it's a glorified fan game. No offense to fan games, of course. It's not designed by the normal people behind the wheel. Even still, the concept and the conceit clips...
They were not levels designed by Inafune.
Or his staff therein, yeah. It's still... But the concept still works beautifully. It's still compelling. It's still... You know, you pick it up and you say you're going to play for 10 minutes and then an hour later you're like, shit, the pizza place that I'm supposed to be at picking up my food right now is probably hella pissed at me. I say that because that's obviously a thing that actually happened to me.
Back in 1987?
No, like a week ago.
Okay, I was going to say like, wow, dude, you were like, what, 6 years old and having to go get pizza for your family? Anyway, but I think the thing is that, you know, 1987, just thinking about the types of games that were out back then, which, of course, there were a lot of great games in that late 80s era, but, you know, especially from Capcom, but just to think that even compared to, like, I don't know. I don't want to say anything bad about Super Mario Brothers, but
you say something bad about Super Mario Brothers? I don't even think that's possible.
Because, you know,
you're the biggest fanboy I've ever seen.
Because Super Mario Brothers, of course, revolutionized platform gaming, but also so did Mega Man. I mean, I just think that the the concept had not been seen before. And I mean, sure, you can say that about a lot of games, but the fact that it still is so compelling to this day, like you said, in that a remake of it, even though it's a little bit easier and, you know, has selectable difficulties and all that, you know, still is as addictive as it was 25 years ago. I mean, it's truly something that stood the test of time.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that's the perfect segue into another game that has really
stood... Mega Man 1 isn't even the best in the series.
No, I don't think I've ever met a single human being who thought that that was the best game in the series. I wanna take a quick moment, actually, to discuss the only Mega Man 1 anecdote I have. Because this would have happened when I was maybe 7 years old. I want to say 7. So, we rented Mega Man 1 from Blockbuster Video. If you recall, in the late 80s, nobody really was buying games. You just rented them all, mostly from Blockbuster Video, although if you had, like, a local mom-and-pop rental shop, you'd probably go to one of them if you were fortunate enough for them to have games that weren't, like, Slalom or Donkey Kong 3. You know, no offense to those games, but they're not Mega Man. Anyway, have this game, playing it as a small boy, woke up super early on a Sunday morning so that I could play it before the family woke up and wanted to watch television, and I made it all the way up to Wily's Castle, and then could not beat the Yellow Devil sub-boss.
Oh, man.
I spent literally all day. I never beat him. You know, I know now as an adult that there's a really easy exploit that you can glitch that fight out by pausing the game and unpausing it and repausing and unpausing. But not only would my pride not have allowed me to do that, but we didn't have the internet back then.
Right.
So I spent probably 8 hours, 8 solid hours,
Dying,
just repeatedly, just dying.
And I have something that I want to say about
level.
That, actually.
Yes?
But I just had a thought. Just imagine 25 years ago what you could have done with a Wii U gamepad. Oh, hey, Mom and Dad want to watch TV. I'll just switch over to my little screen that's on my controller. Fucking Nintendo, man. How far they've come.
Yeah. In fact, I still remember it pretty well. I threw a pretty hardcore tantrum about how I was renting this game and I didn't have it forever, and I really deserved to get to play all day that Sunday for one reason or another. And
I
would
say
remarkably,
that's a pretty well argued reason.
Yeah, I mean, remarkably,
unless you were like, you know, pounding the floor and crying.
No, not my style, but. You know, I definitely had to argue for it, and, you know, I had to leave it on pause and turn the TV to the cable box or whatever, like
I think
channel clicky box at the time.
Oh, yeah, we all did that at one time or another.
So, and you know, come back to it later in the day and get another hour in and totally lose my rhythm. It was awful. But anyway.
What I wanted to comment on, and, you know, this is kind of a thread that can be carried through to all Mega Mans, is that, you know, usually when you die in a game, you get super pissed off. At least if you're me, that's what happens. And so I was like, you know, I was remembering back when I was a kid trying to play Mega Man games, just hella dying. And as a kid, just I was like, oh, I don't have the patience for this. But strangely, and I mean, I think it's just a testament to the level of challenge and reward that the Mega Man games present. When I died, and I died a lot, even though I was playing powered up, so that means I'm probably a total pussy. But, you know, there's a learning curve, and there's a level of, you just can't rush in to it.
Well, there's a definite rhythm to it.
There's a rhythm to it. And I think that's what I appreciate now as an adult, looking at how this game was how these games were designed. But that said, dying, I was just like, oh shit. And if I was getting to a point where I was dying a lot, I would just be like, okay, well, I'm going to put it down for a bit. I'll come back later and give it another go. Because, of course, I had the luxury of saving, but, you know, password dots, so... No, wait, password dots weren't in 1. That started with 2, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mega Man 2 is the one that sort of introduced the password system to the proceedings.
Yeah, and I mean, I was just thinking, if you had the password system for 1, you could have just been like, oh, hold on, Mom, I just need to write down my password dots.
Yeah. I don't operate like that. I would not have admitted okay. that to her, because then she could have been like, okay, why don't you turn this game off, get your password, and then do your chores. Like, bitch, I ain't trying to do all that.
So anyways, what I was saying, and I don't want to spend too much more time on Mega Man 1, but like I said, I had the luxury of being able to save and come back to it. But that said, you know, coming back to it, I always felt more determined to, you know, get through that stage or, you know, beat that robot master. And I've definitely found that as I kept playing, that I would be getting better. So, you know, there's a learning yeah. curve, but it's rewarding. And, like, when you feel that you start getting that rhythm down, I think that was what was most significant for me experiencing it again, like, without... you know, looking at it through a more critical lens, as opposed to just being a 5 or 6 year old child with no patience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about Mega Man 2 then. And I've attempted to make this segue a couple times now, but I think this is the time. Mega Man 2. As an adult, have you played Mega Man 2?
As an adult, yeah. I'm playing through it. I'm playing through it right now. But not, like, right now while we're recording, but I yeah. am in the process of a playthrough currently.
If you don't mind my asking, how far in are you? How many robot masters have you downed?
I think 4.
Okay, so you're like a third of the way through the game.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, do you want my thoughts on it first?
I would love to hear your thoughts on Mega Man 2, because I could talk about Mega Man 2 every minute for every day for the rest of my life and not run out of things to say about Mega Man 2.
I don't doubt that. I think one of the most obvious points to make is, oh my god, that music.
Yeah, the music in Mega Man 2 is just so damn good.
What is your favorite theme?
Airman.
See, I'm very partial to Bubble Man.
When you say theme, of course, I'm thinking only of the Robot Masters.
Okay,
once you get to the Wily stages, you'll understand why everybody is about the Mega Man 2 Wily themes. Because there's like nothing else that good in the entire history of the NES in terms of music. I appreciate all of the Koji Kondo compositions in Mario and Zelda, but it's just like, man, this isn't Dr. Wily. You need to get out of here with all this. So I'll be eager to hear what you have to say when you get a little closer to the end.
Like the ones that like the mini bosses and stuff have done, right?
Oh yes, yes. But yeah, it's yes. But it's different hearing it in the context of the game.
Oh yeah, I'm sure, because I think even hearing the title theme, I was like, okay, I'm getting a little emotional right now. You know, because you know, of course, I'd heard that game music. For years at that point, you know,
yeah,
through the internets or whatever, you know.
You know, continue.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, you know, like I was saying, like, I love the level theme from Bubble Man. is what I'm thinking of. Level music, so I guess maybe not theme, but just there's just I like you said, I can't believe how good that music is. It's just it's something else. And you know, of course, like the Mario music's timeless, the Zelda music is timeless, and like a lot of those Capcom games, like the Disney ones and such, and other Capcom games had really good music. But I mean, it's nothing like Mega Man 2.
Nothing is like Mega Man 2.
And you know, that's just a very I don't even want to say that's a superficial point, because I think that's one thing that makes that game so special. But I think it's really notable. Of course, you did point out the password system, which is very helpful. But I think the really notable thing is just how well-designed the levels are. Not that the Mega Man 1 had bad level design, but just how... And you've explained this to me before, just that there's like almost a language.
Well, there is, and I was waiting for a pause where I could interject, and this is perfect. Though not an interjection, one supposes. But I really feel very strongly that Mega Man 2 is sort of the prime example of a game using sort of its own convention and developing within itself sort of an internal set of logistics wherein it communicates to you through its visuals and through its design. Like, to give you an example... There will be a pit. You will approach the pit to jump over it, and a little fireball or something will come out of the ground to hit you. And the first time you come across this, you'll barely miss it. You're not expecting it, but it's timed in such a way that you have just enough time to jump over it and not get hit. And so then the next time you see a pit, you're like, oh shit, I better approach this carefully, because there's going to be some motherfucking fire in that pit. And so you approach it, and sure enough, there is fire, but this time there are two. So if you had just rushed and not utilized what the game just told you to beware, you'd get hit and probably fall into that pit. But because the game is, as it's going on, teaching you how to play itself, you now are equipped with the tool as a player to approach the challenges being brought to you. And that's, of course, the most bare-bones way I could think to explain the concept of visual language that this game really brings to the table.
But I'm so glad that you brought that up, because later on in our episode, I want to revisit that topic with a different game outside of this series.
Oh, excellent.
A couple different games. But
well, and we'll, I think a lot of people, in fact, I remember reading an article on IGN, this was probably a few years ago, where...
Wait, IGN still runs articles? No, I kid.
Talking about how Mega Man 2 really sort of defined what platforming and action games could be by sort of developing this. And, you know, it's easy to say that, oh, Mario did this, but Mario did great things. Yes, oh, absolutely.
But I mean, I would almost argue that some of the things that we see... in, like, New Super Mario Brothers Wii, I'm sorry, New Super Mario Brothers U, but also Wii, I might not be direct, but, I mean, I really think that Mega Man, and probably specifically Mega Man 2, impacted platform gaming to the point of, even if it's not directly like, oh, we need to do this because it was in Mega Man 2. I think platforming games in general only grew from that point in terms of, you know, kind of communicating through level design. I think it just really showed the gaming industry, look, this is how a well-designed level should look.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't say contemporaneously necessarily that it was looked at that way at the time, but certainly within a couple of years, because this was a very successful series in a time when games weren't selling in the millions to be popular. We're talking about a game that was estimated to have moved something like 1.5 million units.
That's just crazy.
So, I mean, you have to sort of look at, after that kind of success, of course people were looking at it, and you know, for a minute, it seems so weird now because Mega Man is all but forgotten in many ways and in many circles. It's easy to forget that this game propelled Mega Man to, like, premier status. This was such a huge series, and it was so important, and it impacted so many developers and gamers. And most interestingly, you know, Keiji Inafune-san has said that he felt Mega Man 2 was the single reason why the Mega Man series became a hit and could continue to spawn sequels.
And you know what we haven't even mentioned yet about Mega Man 2? I'm sorry. And
if you interrupted me for what I was about to say, I am going to behead you. Continue.
No, no, why don't you just continue, because it might be the same thing.
Continue.
I don't want to be beheaded, though.
Okay, I won't behead you, just continue.
Well, this was a game that was basically developed in their free time.
Yep, that's where I was going with this. So, you know, it's...
Off
it's...
with my head!
No, no, I won't behead you. I'm simply happy you hold this game in proper regard. This game, you know, Inafune-san's team, they were not going to be making a Mega Man sequel. And this team felt so passionate about Mega Man 1 and what... Because, you know, Mega Man 1 was a moderate success. It didn't lose the money, but there was more money to be made on other things. You know, arcade ports and all that. So, and, you know, arcade adaptations, as Capcom was deservedly popular for at the time. But this team, they felt really strongly about sort of their ideas for Mega Man and how they could make Mega Man 1 a better game, and what they could add to it. So they basically, after their normal work day, in between tasks on the projects they were working on, they spent their free personal time to make Mega Man 2. They were so passionate, and they loved this idea and these concepts so much that they were just like, I'm going to sleep in the office. I'm going to sleep on a tatami mat if I have to. We are going to make this game because we know this game is going to be super good if we can just put it together.
And I mean, I think that's evident in how well put together it is. I mean, you can just, and like I've said, you know, one wasn't a bad game, but I think because they were really trying to prove themselves with two, and it was something that they were passionate about to the point of doing it in their free time. And you know, like, I think that's why just every element of it is just, I mean, I can't even really,
yeah, it was a real labor of love, and they clearly wanted to make it, and it just comes through in every beautiful pixel on the screen. This is something made by people who love games and want to make good games.
And I mean, I just looking at it as an adult, you know, because I honestly couldn't have told you as a kid what Mega Man I played, but I mean, I'm just absolutely blown away by just the intricacies of this game and just what a work of art it is. Any last thoughts on Mega Man 2, Captain Spike?
Perfect game. That's my last thought on it.
Flaw-free. 10 out of 10.
Game of the forever.
I actually have one question. How?
I actually have one answer.
And I mean, obviously we know that it's highly regarded, but was it also critically acclaimed?
Yes. There was. I'm pretty sure, if my memory of circumstance is accurate, I recall pretty much everyone being like, "What?"
Yeah. So, Mega Man 2. Bravo.
This brings us, quite obviously, to Mega Man 3. Now,
and how do you follow up a game like Mega Man 2?
That's a valid question, but I real quick need to make a meta note for the show. It's now December 30th. We're We're behind schedule, as we typically always are. So we're going to try to speed things up a little bit. If it seems like we're not discussing any of these individual Mega Man games as much as any of you out there would like, why don't you tweet at us at GameBuoy.org, and that's, of course, .org as in D-O-T-O-R-G.
GameBuoy.org as in GameBuoy, D-O-T-O-R-G.
And tell us what Mega Man game you'd like to hear more about.
Or Facebook comment us. Or do all those things that we shout out to you at the end of the episode. Stay tuned.
Any of those things. Getting back to it, as Mr. Slagkick has asked, rhetorically, how do you follow up a game like Mega Man 2? Do you have an answer for that, Mr. Slagkick?
I loaded up Mega Man 3 because I wanted to get a little bit of a perspective, and I wasn't really struck with anything that furthered it. And I mean, I'm obviously coming to it with not having the perspective of playing it at the time.
How about Mega Man has a robot dog?
Okay, yeah, that's a cool thing.
How about Mega Man can slide now?
Oh, shit, that's right, okay. See, it's kind of hard for me, having not been growing up with these games, to recognize each what each specific game brought.
How about Top Man?
You would like Top Man.
Oh, whatever. Anyway, it's, you know, your question was a very valid one. Mega Man 3.
I mean, more good level design, but
it's a great game. Has more going on visually than Mega Man 2 does.
That's true. I was struck by that. I'm like, oh, I noticed that it was definitely a step up.
But it's not. It is not. There's something I cannot describe. A kind of je ne sais quoi, I suppose one could say, if one were feeling particularly pretentious, that is simply lacking in Mega Man 3. It's not bad. It was a very successful game. It was critically acclaimed.
Still had pretty good music, too.
Still has good music, absolutely. But, you know, this is the first game, historically speaking, the first game in the series where Keiji Inafune, after the fact, said that this game was difficult to make. One sprang fully born from their fingertips. Two was a labor of love that there was simply no question, but we do this because we must. Three was the first one where it felt like a chore to him. And I think that is maybe part of the same symptom that prevents the game from feeling quite as good as Mega Man 2. But it's still a great game. Still bringing it up in the context of the creme de la creme of the original 10, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's just not that it's fair to compare Mario and Mega Man, but if you think of Japanese Mario 2 and the jump that made, the jump forward from Japanese Mario 2, which of course we know in America as the Lost Levels, but it's actually Mario 2.
You just have to compare everything to Mario, don't
that
you?
That said, but I mean, think about the jump from Mario 2, Japan, Lost Levels, not awesome Mario 2 that we got, Doki Doki Panic, to Mario 3. And like I said, it's not fair to compare, but
yeah, because Mega Man 3 is way better than Mario 3.
Mario 3 is a great game, though.
Disagree.
Ooh, that's
no.
A
judging it on its own merits, it's objectively a good game. It's not really. I don't love it the way many people do.
Anyway, what were your experiences with Mega Man 3? Back in the day.
I really liked it. You know, I talk now as an adult about how much I love Mega Man 2, and I've always loved Mega Man 2. I've loved Mega Man 2 since I was, you know, knee-high to an inchworm. But Mega Man 3...
Man, you were tiny.
Right? But Mega Man 3, was the first Mega Man game that I got, like, at the time of its release. Mega Man 1, as I discussed previously, rented from Blockbuster. Mega Man 2, I was given a used copy by a friend who was moving out of town.
Man, that it was friend his own
copy,
solid.
Right? It was his own copy. The game had only been out for a month or two, and
that
I hadn't...
That is basically like Saria giving Link the Ocarina.
Yeah, right? Like, God, everything has to be about Mario or Zelda with you.
Sorry.
But, you know, and it was... The game was not old yet, and I had just not had, like, a Christmas or birthday since its release to have gotten it, because those were the only circumstances under which I got a game as a kid. So, he did me a proper... I loved Mega Man 2, close to my heart, have, you know, fond memories about this game, also because of, you know, this kid who gave it to me. Mega Man 3, though, was the first one where...
You're like, gotta save up for it.
Exactly. Gotta have a bowl, gotta have cereal. Like,
oh, no, you didn't.
Saved up, did chores around the house before it came out, reading about it in Nintendo Power every month, waiting for it eagerly to come out.
So it was very much something that was hyped for you.
So, yeah, it was major hype get. Mega Man 3 might be the first game I was ever really hyped about. And I think that might go to part of why I feel like it's so much better than I feel it gets from the community. Certainly, Mega Man 3 is nothing to laugh at. It's nothing to snort at or chuckle at. Like, people generally dig Mega Man 3, but it is viewed as, like, a sharp drop from Mega Man 2. And I feel like it's just a very slight drop from Mega Man 2. Again, as I was saying, it was the first one that I really got for myself, and I loved it. And for many years, I thought it was better than Mega Man 2. There's more to it. You have, you know, Rush, Mega Man's robot dog. You have the really cool slide ability, and the sort of strengths and weaknesses of the boss are, bosses, I should say, are way more amplified in Mega Man 3 than they are in Mega Man 2. When you're using, you know, the Top Man attack against Shadow Man, it takes, like, 2 hits to kill him. And if you're fighting with just the Mega Buster, like, no, you're probably just gonna die. So, it definitely, looking at it now as an adult, like, oh yeah, that's unbalanced, that's not good, it's definitely poor design to...
But as a kid, you probably felt like, oh, fuck yeah, I figured out what to use.
It was the coolest power trip. Like, I can totally do this.
I have to ask, without having the internet and, unless there were tips in Nintendo Power.
You know, Nintendo Power used to do, like, maps and stuff, so...
But, of course, I remember them for Mario and Zelda.
And they would list, you know, the proper stage advancements and what have you, and, you know, do this before that and... All of that. So,
okay, but without access to them, how did you figure out boss weaknesses, etc.?
Well,
kind of trial and error?
Primarily trial and error is really the thing that you did back then. Obviously, Nintendo Power, where applicable, was a huge asset. Less so GamePro and video, computer games and video entertainment or whatever. I can't remember that magazine's name anymore. But there were resources out there. It's just you couldn't get all of the information.
Did you ever call the Nintendo hotline?
I did once for Bart versus the Space Mutants.
Okay, so not about Mega Man, though.
Not about Mega Man.
Okay, we'll have to talk about that on a different day, then.
Absolutely.
I'd love to hear that story.
It was really dumb, too. It was literally the dumbest thing. I felt so awful. But anyway. something noteworthy about Mega Man 3, and something that I think maybe a lot of people don't know now, but... They ran it in an issue of Nintendo Power that came out a few months after the game came out, was that you could access the game's debug mode by holding left on a controller plugged into the Player 2 port of your NES. You take a rubber band and wrap it around the controller just to keep the left direction depressed, and then jump into a pit.
What did the left direction ever do to you?
And then you just jump into a pit, and Mega Man wouldn't die. The game wouldn't game over. And suddenly, you would have, like, Mega Moon jumps and infinite health.
Whoa.
So that was cool, and it really let you look at some stuff that you maybe normally couldn't access throughout the game. And
game-breaking stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I think, as far as I know, it's the only Mega Man game with that sort of debug mode left in. You ask me sort of generically what I think of the game, what I remember of the game. It was just all of these really cool, neat little bits of sort of trivia that maybe don't apply to any other Mega Man game. And that's probably also part of why I think it's so cool. It has the introduction of Mega Man's BFF / ultra rival Proto Man, or of course, as you might be familiar with him in Japan, Blues, somewhat amusingly, sometimes mistranslated in the U.S. as Bruce.
Bruce?
Yeah, like B-R-U-C-E.
Like Bruce Willis?
Yes, like Bruce Willis.
And Bruce Springsteen?
Bruce Springsteen. All of them bros. So, game got a positive reception. I love it. A lot of really weird, cool little notes, but not the labor of love that Mega Man 2 was, and it shows. They started trying to tell kind of a storyline and add, you know, these side characters that were sort of marketable. You have, you know, Rush the robot dog that can become like a sled or
they're
little
like, oh, hey, Doctor
platforms.
Who had a robot dog, so why not make a man?
Rush is almost as cool as K-9, but not quite. So,
Thank you, Master. Moving on.
This was supposed to be the game that went fastest to talk about, and I think we talked about Mega Man 3 longer than 1 or 2. So let's close out our chapter on the NES Mega Man games with Mega Man 4. Now, Mr. Slagkick, have you ever seen, touched, heard, tasted, smelled, or played Mega Man 4?
I made a point of trying a few levels.
Oh, goody.
I'm trying to remember what, because I had asked you which one I should start with for 4, I think. Or did I? Maybe it was only for 3.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is the mechanic that pretty much everyone agrees completely changed the Mega Man and every game in the Mega Man series thereafter. The levels you tried, did you have a charge shot?
I don't think I even thought to do that.
Okay.
But I can see where that led to.
Did you play against Pharaoh Man or Frog Man or Toad Man?
No. I think I literally maybe just loaded up a level. There was some platforming thing I couldn't figure out for some reason. I was just like, I'm going to go back to 2 now. So
yeah,
I honestly probably haven't given 4 a fair chance. But having been said, I'll pick that up when we talk about our next game, but
well, Mega Man
4. I can
4,
see where the charge would have been a charge shot would have been a nice addition.
Well, it's nice and it's not. It completely changes the dynamic of the game in terms of design. And somewhat interestingly, because of the way the NES sound processor worked, when you were charging a shot, the game made a very specific pitch noise repeatedly. Which is cool. It gives you feedback as a player that, oh, bro, I have a shot charged. But as a result, it took away one audio channel that the game could be sort of outputting on. So the music on Mega Man 4 is actually less complex than the music from 2 or 3.
Meh.
Yeah, a lot of people, especially in retrospect, view that as a huge ding against Mega Man 4. And unfortunately, that would continue for the later NES Mega Man games, of which I have nothing to really say. Probably the best thing I can say about Mega Man 4 is that, in my personal opinion, it has the best graphics of the NES Mega Man games.
It does. It looks really... Sorry, I was too far away from the mic. Mm-hmm. It does. It actually looks really nice.
And, and it had Eddie the Flip Top.
Okay.
He was a little robot that would come out and sometimes give you items, but...
Aww.
I mean, it's not that cool. It sounds cuter than it is.
But would you still say that it was a good game, despite kind of being...
We're
downhill.
Talking about it, aren't we?
True.
But really, I want to get to... I said Mega Man 2 was my favorite Mega Man game, but I really meant that in the context of
the original Mega Man
series. I want to talk right now about a game that is, if I were to rank my all-time favorite games in 10, what would probably be maybe 6 or 7. I want to talk right now about Mega Man X.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Mr. Slagkick, because I have been speaking for far too long, and I happen to know that you're pretty familiar with this one, why don't you take the ball on Mega Man X?
Yeah, I've also, I just have to point out, these PSP remakes were pretty great. I know, like we've mentioned with Powered Up for Mega Man 1, the difficulty level is decreased a bit, but Mega Man Maverick Hunter X... Am I saying that
or
right?
Or Irregular Hunter X in Japan.
Yes. I think the first time, because I have to confess, I didn't even know until recent years that Mega Man X was even a thing.
Oh, really?
Well, I say recent years, I mean like within this century.
Okay, but, you know, as a game that came out in 93...
I did not know about it at the time.
Century, by the time it was this century, the game was, you know, already 7 years old.
Anyway, I was just really struck with the jump forward that it... I mean, I can't really say to the series because it's a separate series, but...
Yeah, well, you know, my understanding of Mega Man X has always been that Keiji Inafune-san very specifically set out during the development of Mega Man X to sort of reinvent Mega Man.
Kind of make it a little darker, a little edgier, more mature.
Well, and to expand the gameplay concepts. So to sort of let the player not only grow by getting new weapons, but also to get... like new movement abilities, so you would start with the ability to, you know, climb walls, and then throughout the game you'd learn how to dash, and you would learn how to break certain blocks with a helmet, and you'd learn how to charge your robot master weapons, and really just, you know, again, expand not just the kinds of weapons you're using, but also how you interact as Mega Man with the game world around you.
Yeah, and I'm just having a great time with it.
Have you not finished it yet?
I haven't. I'm in the Stigma Palace, and it's just those damn fish things with, like, the spotlight.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you're coming down and there's, like, the little razor thingies, and you're like, okay, I gotta dodge those. And I did fine with that in Launch Octopus's level. It was a little mini boss of sorts that you would come across, but it's... You know, on the platforms, and there's some spikes down in the pit, and I'm just haven't quite nailed it yet. So I'm just kind of still trying to plow through that. But I mean, just the boss fights, and I mean, like the mechanics that were added. I just think it's a hell of a game.
Yeah. Yeah, it really... Again, Mega Man X is one of my favorite games of all time. I can't really overstate how much I like this game. So I would primarily... I mean, I guess, really, this game is available on PSP. It's, you know, thus available on Vita. It is available on the Wii Virtual Console for, you know, the SNES section. I would really just recommend that you download this game and play it if you haven't before. Just absolutely one of my very best.
I would maybe suggest to newcomers, give me my perspective on it, find a way to play Mega Man 2 first so that you don't spoil it. Not that I think that playing Mega Man X first would take away from what's special about Mega Man 2, but just to really appreciate where the game came from, the best of... that first set of games, and to see where it evolved to.
I do want to say, I'm looking at my show notes, and I see that there is a version of Mega Man X available on iOS.
Is there really?
Don't play that. I knew this because I've played it. Now that I think about it, like, oh yeah, I did play that. But no, don't. Just please don't.
That doesn't. I can't see where that would be good.
There was a PC port in 95. If anything, just try to track that down. Do not play the iOS version.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing good can come of that. Sort of cutting to the chase here. Mega Man X 2. Have you played it yet, Mr. Sidekick?
I haven't. But I definitely intend to after I finish X.
Okay. Great game. Not quite as impressive as X1, still cool. That's about what I have to say about Mega Man X2.
And then what happened to the rest of the X series?
There are varying stages of great and awful. We've discussed here on the show how I feel like Mega Man X6 is sort of unfairly hated. But, again, it's unfairly hated because it stands among giants.
Right.
It taken on its own merits is actually not that bad, but for a Mega Man game, it's probably like, you look at this whole series, there's probably like 50 games among the various spin-offs and what
so
have
crazy.
You. And it's like, I'd probably say X6 is probably like one of the top, like, or not top, one of the like last five in terms of ranking. Like, ooh, there are literally like beta test games that leaked for Super Nintendo that are better than this.
Aww.
Like Mega Man Super Nintendo games. So, the next one I really have much to say about is Mega Man 9.
Yay.
Which was a revival of the 2D Mega Man franchise from just a few years back. If you're listening to this, you've probably played it in some context. But still talk a little bit about it. Mr. Slagkick, do you have any thoughts on Mega Man 9?
9 and 10 I've only watched you play. I haven't had a chance to dive into them yet.
Okay.
From what I've noticed, and you can probably add some more insight to this, it seems like the level of challenge is definitely still there. You know, considering that these PSP remakes kind of lowered the difficulty, and I mean, even thinking of Mega Man 2, which added the normal difficulty in... which is actually an easy, and the difficult is normal, but, you know, so it seems like they're like, no, we're not gonna fuck around, this is a Mega Man game.
Well, you know, Inafune-san very specifically said that they looked at Mega Man 2 and said, Mega Man 9 is going to be a sequel to that.
Oh.
So Mega Man 9 strips away the slide from Mega Man 3, and the charge shot from Mega Man 4.
Oh, really? So it's really a back to basics then.
And the climbing and dashing and shit from the X series. And it is
Well, yeah, because it's not a Mega Man X game.
It is back to the meat and potatoes of jumping and shooting. And frankly, I think it's superb for it. I think it was a great choice. You know, it was very controversial when this game was announced that it was going to be using art design, not just inspired by, but straight up... and NES art design. Like, it is pixels, it is fat pixels, jumping, 8-bit sounds. There's a little bit of, like, sprite warping effects and stuff that you could not have done on real NES hardware, but for the most part, it's just an NES game made in the late 2000s.
And that announcement was really that polarizing?
Oh, it was very polarizing.
Now thinking about it, I'm like, fuck yeah, vintage-looking games.
Yeah, there were a lot of people at the time decrying it as a sign that the end was nigh for gaming in general. Like, oh, this
what?
Is a sign that gaming innovation has stopped, that this game is not... It's reached its end, it can never go any further than this. So
I guess I missed out on that.
You are good. It's not bad that you missed that. It's good that you missed that.
Because I just... You know, I love that. I've talked about... And you're going to hate me, but... New Super Mario Brothers, you know. So I love when it's a throwback to the vintage. So that's kind of surprising to learn.
Mega Man 10, you know, I don't really have any more to add to what I just said about Mega Man 9. That all still applies.
The most recent Mega Man game that we've had.
Well, you know, that was officially made by Capcom. There is, and this is one to maybe talk about a little, the release last week of Street Fighter Cross Mega Man.
I actually haven't had a chance to check that out because I was in Disneyland when that came out. And, you know, Mega Man's cool, but Disneyland.
You're awful in every way.
You're just jealous that you weren't there as well.
No, because I was playing Street Fighter Cross Mega Man.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So the level design is kind of awful. You know, I mean, I'm being
a fan game.
Again, I'm being very subjective here. This is a series that's near and dear to my heart. Mega Man 2 and Mega Man X, each I have probably played more than 50 times. Like, I truly believe that if you were to count the number of times I've played Mega Man 2 and Mega Man X, probably those are my number 2 and number 3 most played games of all time. Number 1, of course, is Demon's Crest. I've talked about that in quite a few episodes previous. And somewhat interestingly, Demon's Crest was made by a lot of the same staff as Mega Man X. But going back to Street Fighter Cross Mega Man, the talent in level design is just not there. There's a lot of cheap hits, hits that you have no real effective dodge for. None of the bosses have attack patterns. That's something that's very important, of course, with the visual language of Mega Man being such an important, vital part of the game design. It's a little bit frustrating to have these robot masters who are—they're not robot masters; they're fucking Street Fighters. And they play the way Street Fighter characters play in the Street Fighter fighting games. So it's very difficult to sometimes have a computer opponent who, you know, at the full screen away from you is not shooting his, you know, air blower at you or whatever. But instead, he's, like, trying to bait you into jumping into his Shoryuken. It's cool.
Like the concept was cute, but the execution maybe was a little flawed.
Well, it's an interesting take on Mega Man. Those boss fights in particular, you know, I talk about it, about how it's undesirable. But it's actually an interesting take. It's cool to play and check out and see how Mega Man and the Mega Man character's tool set works with those kinds of encounters.
So it's more like a Marvel Comics What If?
Yes, that's quite apt. It's
What If, instead of Robot Masters, there were Street Fighters?
Yes, very much. And, you know, you do learn, you know, Hadoukens, and you learn, you know, Yoga Flame or whatever. Like, so it's...
That's cute.
It's cool. It's actually not bad.
Do you get some big Chun-Li Thunderfies?
There are some pretty big Chun-Li thighs in the game.
No, I mean,
Mega
Man. Do you get them? Does
Mega Man's
get them?
Thighs do not grow in size when you
and
have Chun-Li equipped.
I just have to say that I don't mean that in any misogynistic way. I love Chun-Li. She's probably my favorite Street Fighter to use.
No, but if you step
and
back
I love
objectively,
her big muscular thighs.
If you step back objectively and look at Chun-Li's thighs,
she got some big old thunder thighs.
They are ridiculous.
But you know what? They're probably some childbearing hips. So,
yeah,
I'm just digging myself into a hole.
You really are, and not a fun hole.
Oh!
I didn't even mean it like that. Jesus.
Oh. We should probably...
Yeah, we are getting punch drunk. It is time to fast track it.
Yeah, we should probably wrap up
We're
so we can
talk about
our next
discussion
point. We're
done talking
about
the best of the games. I was going to talk a little bit about the rest of the games, but instead maybe just check out Wikipedia. I hate to do that to you, but the games you should look at... Really,
I have a quick question that I'd like to hear your thoughts on, though.
Hold on. We'll get to that. I know what you're going to ask because I cheated and we've talked about how we're going to approach this episode. Let me just go over the good Mega Man spinoffs real quick and then we'll get to yours because I know it's going to be the last one I mention. Let's see. I would say do play Mega Man The Power Battle. Do play Mega Man The Power Battle 2 The Power Fighters. Do play the Game Boy spinoffs 1, 4, and 5. Do not play
Battle Network? Game Boy Advance or Game Boy?
No, the original Game Boy.
I didn't even realize there was a Game Boy.
Oh, yes. 1, 2, 3, and 4 are remixes of Mega Man NES 1, 2, 3, and 4. And Game Boy Mega Man 5 is all new, all original level designs and robot masters, and it's actually like quite superb.
It's better than NES Mega Man 5.
Yeah, I think so. I do. I actually do think so. Do play Mega Man and Bass if you get the chance. Play Mega Man Command Mission, which is a Mega Man X JRPG.
Wow.
It's about as awesome as it sounds. Do not play the Game Boy Color Mega Man Extreme or Mega Man Extreme 2. Do play Mega Man Battle Network 1 and 3. Do not play the GameCube Mega Man Network Battle Network Transmission.
That's just a mouthful.
That was an awful, awful game. I call special attention to the Mega Man Zero games for Game Boy Advance and the Mega Man ZX games for DS. Any of the games in those series are great. They're very Metroidvania-inspired, sort of take Zero or the, you know, analog for Mega Man or Zero if you're playing a ZX. And, you know, sort of explore these gigantic environments and learn new movement abilities through Robot Masters so that you can access new areas in the Metroidvania style.
That's super rad. I gotta check that out.
The series, however, and this has been in the news a lot this year, you must know what Mega Man spin-off series I'm going to suggest you play. If you have the opportunity, do not play Mega Man 64, but do play Mega Man Legends 1 or 2. Mr. Slagcake, I believe you have something to say.
Well, just to clarify, Mega Man 64 is technically Mega Man Legends 1, right?
It is
but it's watered down.
It is a port of Mega Man Legends 1 that fails in every way.
I just wanted to clarify that, yes, those are the same game, but
they are not the same game.
Okay, okay.
I mean, the differences that make Mega Man 64 not work are so extreme that I would not call them the same game.
Okay. Now, the question I have is a theoretical one, hypothetical one. When I was thinking about, you know, obviously we've talked about on air, and we talked about on our Capcom, not Capcom, the Gaming Giants episode, which we discussed Capcom, they've really neglected Mega Man, and I'm just really curious, even if it doesn't seem like it would be your cup of tea, why do you think that we never saw a Wiimote Mega Man Legends game?
I don't think Capcom knows how to market the Mega Man Legends series. I think that we saw that with the Mega Man Legends 3 fiasco, where Capcom asked fans to assist designing the game. They had extensive polling and like art challenges for like, oh, what do you think? How do you think this character's gloves should look? And they, you know, they claim that they just felt that the audience participation was just not coming through. They felt that the game wouldn't, you know, not be profitable or whatever. I mean, Mega Man Legends 3 is really sort of the case study for exactly what you're asking. And the short answer for why Capcom didn't make a Mega Man Legends for Wii, and I actually think that could have been a very good thing. Unfortunately, I think the answer is that Capcom didn't see money in it.
That's sad.
So,
and I mean, as we talked about on our Capcom, I keep calling it our Capcom episode, our Gaming Giants episode.
Well, that's the episode where I talked about Capcom nonstop through like the entire episode. So,
right,
I was acting like you on Zelda Mario.
The thing is, though, that we made a point on that episode, which you can find on our GameBuoy.org archives.
GameBuoy.org archives.
That, you know, Capcom's doing very well, and they're doing very well financially. It's just kind of sad that
they're making good business choices, but I don't always like that.
And it's just, that's sad because, I mean, we've talked about the whole Legends 3 fiasco before, so we need not elaborate on it, but it's just, it's a shame. I'm definitely looking forward to giving Legends a proper go. But, you know, just knowing the basic concept behind Legends, I'm like, damn, this would would have made a really good Wii game, but...
Well, with that in mind, last bit before we move on to our next topic.
Yes, we still have another topic.
What do you hope happens looking forward in the Mega Man franchise?
I hope we get another game.
Well, it's, if nothing else, it's worth mentioning. Capcom is, you know, heavily tracking. Capcom themselves have confirmed that they're heavily tracking how many people download Street Fighter Cross Mega Man. So I implore you
go
all.
Go download it, please.
Go download really Street it. Fighter Cross Mega Man, even if you're not going to play it. Like, that is definitely a thing you should do. Download it for us. I will personally give you a hug. I will personally, I don't know, ruffle your hair or whatever you think is cool when a gay bro does to you, because I'll do it. I mean, as long as it's not dirty.
I mean, it makes sense, but it's also kind of like if Capcom was a Tumblr user, and they're like, oh, if you retumble my blog post and I get 10,000 notes on it, I'll...
get a tattoo of a hippo eating a squirrel.
And post a picture of it.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm really hoping that Capcom sees that people want Mega Man, you know, for the anniversary, which was this week. The whole reason why we're talking about Mega Man, Capcom has started putting the original NES Mega Man games on the 3DS Virtual Console. If you have a 3DS and you like Mega Man, download that shit. Let Capcom see that there is demand for this series, that they can make money on it. Because money is what really motivates a game company at this point. Money and seeing that...
Most,
like,
game companies.
I know where you're going with that, and I'm just going to have to argue it when we get there. It's absolutely vital at this point in Mega Man for where we're at now that if you're a fan of this series... you need to put your best dollar forward and show Capcom how they can make it rain.
Because, I mean, what's... do you think that it's possible that we will never see a new Mega Man game?
I don't think that's possible. I do think it's possible that after this year... I think, frankly, for the 25th anniversary, there's probably a new Mega Man game coming. But... if it doesn't do well,
it might be the swan song.
It could be. I'm not very happy at that prospect, but I think it's a possibility.
And I mean, I don't know what it would take. Like, do you think that Inafune or Capcom? You know, obviously Inafune is with Concept now.
Inafune is Concept.
He is Concept. I'm sorry. Yes. He's founded a Concept, which we've talked about quite a bit. Do you think that either of them... do you think that Capcom would be like, okay, Inafune-san, we want to partner with Concept to make a new Mega Man game because we need to be good?
Anything's possible, but I don't think it's likely.
Yeah. This poor Blue Bomber, he deserves so much more than he gets.
He do. In brighter news... it's on to topic two.
Yes.
We are going to keep this quick. Our average topic discussion goes for about 35 minutes. Let's see if we can do this in 10.
All right. Why don't you tell them what we're going to do?
So, we discussed our games of the year last week.
Or in my case, games of the year that I can't wait to play because I have a huge backlog.
It was brought to our attention... that we missed several games in this discussion that should have been discussed, and further, that we didn't really quite settle on individual games of the year. So it's time to do that. For me, the games that I was sort of, that were sort of put forward to me, because, you know, I, of the two of us, it's no secret that I'm the one who sort of plays more games. But it was really brought to my attention that I had completely skipped over two really important games that came out in 2013. I'm getting pudge drunk. Can you tell? So, two really important games that came out in 2012 that I completely neglected. Those games are Journey for the PlayStation 3 and The Walking Dead for PC, 360, PS3. There might be an iOS version, IDK. It was also suggested to me that I play Unit 13 for Vita and Paper Mario Sticker Star for 3DS. So I played all four of those since our last episode to get the easy ones out of the way. Not super impressed with Paper Mario Sticker Star. I thought that a lot of the things that make the Paper Mario series special were stripped away from this game and put in their place. Some interesting game concepts that ultimately are not what I play Paper Mario games for. Unit 13 was a really great third-person shooter in the arcade style of a game you might remember from the beginning of this console generation called The Club. You're going for sort of score attacks, getting kill chains, getting headshots, being super efficient, and then getting scored on that on a leaderboard to be ranked against your bros. It's compelling, but it's not game of the year. It's the sort of thing that I'm happy to have and will revisit.
It's a good Vita game?
it's a good game. I like it. It's the kind of thing I'm attracted to, but there's not a lot to it. It's not super special. It's just fun and compelling.
I'm good.
The Walking Dead is, of course... I've seen many Game of the Year nominations for The Walking Dead this year. And I'll be honest, I don't see it. I think it's a good game. I'm sort of in the third chapter. And I don't want to talk about the game's content.
Is it possible that it just is about to amp up and you have no
idea? It is possible. There might be someone right now listening to this broadcast
who is like, oh, he doesn't even know.
Ooh, yeah, like maybe he's like, ooh, girl, this about to blow up. This place about to blow.
And I'm then like, we get to hear about how you ugly cried.
Yeah, and if that happens, that'll be great, and I'll talk about it next week, of course. I just don't see it. I feel like I'm playing a choose-your-own-adventure book with some really ham-fisted sort of... like, oh, I guess I can't call this a puzzle, but it's still less complex than...
You know, kind of what I was saying about, you know, the best might be yet to come. Rob Roberts from OLR, Orange Lounge Radio, said that it might be one of the best game endings in the history of gaming.
Now, see, and that's interesting, and when I get there, you know, hopefully that's how I feel too. But right now, I feel like I'm playing a more generic version of what Hideo Kojima was doing on PC in the late 80s. Like, I feel like I'm playing a watered-down generic version of Snatcher with zombies put in. Huh. And it's not... I just don't find that
super
compelling.
And you like
compelling.
Snatcher, though,
oh,
right?
I love Snatcher. I think it's an amazing game, but it's an amazing game that's, like, 20 years old. I think that interactive storytelling has come a long way. And no way could I possibly have foreseen where I could see that on display more effectively than in Journey.
Oh, my goodness.
I know you have a lot of things to say about Journey, so I'm just going to say that Journey is probably my second favorite game I played in 2012. My first, I will clarify, after Mr. Slagkick has hit all of his talking points... which I think should happen right about now.
Now, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about this first point. I just wanted to give a little update. We've talked a lot about New Super Mario Bros. U, how great it is. I just wanted to say I experienced boost mode over the holidays, had some family over, and my mom was actually the one who was doing boost mode. It was just kind of really fascinating to me because, you know, my mom's not a gamer. Did I ever tell... I think I told the story on our Gaming Giants episode about how my mom was trying to play a Capcom game. I think it was Chippendale Rescue Rangers.
Yes, and they were in attract mode and weren't controlling their characters.
So that said, you know, my mom, like, from the baby boomer generation, so, you know, she's not, like, terrified of technology and video games, but, you know, she's the type of person who, when she grew up, like, Pong was a big deal, you know, so we have to think about that context.
Yeah.
So anyway, boost mode, and I said I wasn't going to spend too much time, but, you know, just for someone, I would not consider her a gamer, but as my sister and I were playing through, at first we had to be like, oh, hey, Mom, put a platform right here. She'd be like, here, and then she'd put one there, and they're like, no, above the crack so we don't have to worry about falling or whatever. And, okay, it's a little bit cheap. It kind of makes the game easier.
That's fine, though. Games don't have to be hard to be fun.
That said, it just in the same way that we've talked about the Wii U gamepad providing an engaging experience and opening up communication, like with the Nintendo Land, not only did we that encourage that instead of just, you know, playing the game and, you know, not really having a ton of interaction. Although I would argue that even the originally new Super Mario Brothers Wii was pretty interactive with the co-op, but
yes, continue.
I think the biggest thing that I was struck by is just that as she got more used to using boost mode, like she was starting to figure out in her own way, like how
she could assist,
how could she assist, and like how the
she
level
could
design.
Participate and go with the flow of the level.
And I mean, I think. For, you know, a middle-aged woman who's not a gamer to be engaging with level design like that, I think that's pretty significant.
Yeah, that sounds really incredible, frankly.
I just talked about that way more than I wanted to. What I've been dying to talk about all episode is the fact that I got a new PS3. Just really briefly, as you probably know, I've held a grudge against Sony for pretty much exactly 2 years. Christmas of 2010, my original PS3 stopped reading discs. And, you know, I could have had Sony pay $100 to fix it, but at the time I was just so pissed off. I was holding a grudge. And, you know, I have to say that looking back on it now, a lot of what I had to say about Sony this past year on the podcast was probably from that sort of negative place. I still think that some of Sony's business decisions are questionable. But I finally broke down. I thought, you know, I need to give it another chance. Got a really good trade-in deal on my defective PS3, surprisingly, from GameStop. So good on them. I'm just really happy, and I can see that I have missed out on some amazing experiences. I picked up the Journey Collection, and I started with Flow. And, you know, Flow's pretty cool, but I didn't get super engaged with it. What I thought was interesting, and I'm leading up to a point here, is that Flow, and like what you were saying about the language of game design and how it communicates to you how to play it, Flow did a pretty good job at that, I thought. Flower, the spiritual successor to Flow, did an even better job, I feel. And, I mean, Flower is just a very special little game. And, you know, just really beautiful. And I think at the time, 2008, that game could not have come out on any console but the PS3. You know, it could have been a Wii game, but I don't think it would have looked as pretty, which is a superficial thing to say, but, you know, I think the visual experience of Flower is something that contributes to what makes it so special and immersive. But that said, the evolution of that game company, I'm not just saying that game company, they're of course called That Game Company.
That Game Company.
Yes, and I just think that...
You know, That Game Company. That Game Company.
That Game Company, That Game Company, yeah. I think that just really that the epitome of what they've been trying to do, which is, you know, really focus on the emotion of a game, is they've really reached I think they've really reached a new level with that in Journey. And I don't want to spoil Journey for you. It's very I don't even want to say it's minimal, because they're very much so their most fully fleshed out game so far. It's just an amazing experience, and like the other games that came before it, Flow and Flower, does a really superb job of communicating to you how to play the game, and you know, the thing that's most significant that you might have heard about it, and if you've played it, you definitely know about it, is that you can come across anonymous people who are actually playing the game with you. Of course, at the very end, it will reveal who you had journeyed with. But I was talking with your partner about this. One of the amazing things is just, and I've also kind of just seen this on internet message boards and such, and just the bond that you form with this anonymous partner that you can only communicate to with a little shout that has, like, little unique symbols that signifies your journeyer, so to speak. It's just, it's really, really intense. And, I mean, just thinking about it makes me feel a little emotional. Because I have to say, when I played Flower, I'm not even gonna front. I got a little emotional. I didn't straight up cry, but I was just, like, very moved by Flower. Journey, I'm just gonna say it, I was straight up crying at the end of Journey. It's just such a beautiful game, and I mean, I might have had a slightly different experience than you did, but I don't want to spoil it for you, but at the very end of the game, I had been journeying with another player who I had no idea who it was. You know, there was no way of communicating, but with little shouts, which really just the little language of the shouts is, like, even can be intense. Like, it, you know, like, whether you're doing it frantically or, like, okay, I'm here. It's amazing how communicative it can be in that simplicity. But anyway, at the very end, right before the end of the game, and if you played the game, you finished it, you know what I'm talking about. My little traveling companion traced a heart in the snow, and I was just like, I mean, I'm just getting a little emotional thinking about it. It was just probably the most intense emotional experience I've had with a game, and I still can't believe that. And you know, I find it really remarkable that that game company is more you know. And you said you might beg to differ, but that they're focused on creating an emotional experience, creating something that's a work of art. Not that other games aren't works of art, but they've said that they have no interest in creating blockbuster titles because they really just want to create games that, you know, can really evoke an emotional response.
Contextually, I just want to point out that the only reason I disagreed with you earlier was that I was talking about people making games for profit, and it was very clear by the look on your face that you were going to bring this game up as not for profit.
That said, it has been extremely successful.
And that's precisely my point. They did something quite incredible and amazing, but I think once they had it on paper, I think it was a slam dunk. I think that this is a concept that as soon as you hear about it, you just want to play it. It's just such a special game.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that they weren't.
Even when the art for this game was first being shown and the trailers and sort of, it was clear that this was something special.
And, you know, like I said, I'm not going to spend too much time more talking about it, and I don't want to spoil it, but they've gone on record saying that they don't really particularly have any message they want to convey in their games. They just want to convey emotion. And an interesting point is that when they had early beta testers or focus groups for Flower, that people thought it was kind of trying to push an environmentalist, like a green sort of approach, and so that they went back and kind of changed it so that it's just more focused on the emotion.
And I'm happy they did that. I liked Flower tremendously. I just finally played through it myself all the way through last night, having previously only watched other
people play. I heard that you were very particular about getting every single flower.
I'm going to slap that hoe. No, it's, you know, the thing is, I'm not the kind of gamer that is, oh, namby-pamby, I'll get what I happen to get, and otherwise I'll just
succeed. Well,
yeah, succeed.
We've talked about that with you 100% in New Super Mario Brothers. You and
no, I will 100% every level of every game I play the first time I play it, and if I fail to do that, I will replay that level and achieve all of my objectives before I allow myself to move on. There is no room for leeway or being lax.
Anyway,
That is just not fun or compelling for me. And the reason why I just put my hand up and said, no, you're going to stop talking so I can finish my thought, is because I think the first time in the history of ever that I didn't feel that way was the last level of Flower. And so whereas I felt like the first four or five levels were a chore, I felt like I was being preached to, there was this awful mechanic where I was losing my collectibles, which was irritating as shit.
Oh, are you talking about like in the kind of dark level?
Yes, I am.
That was something else that was a surprise.
I do not like this game giving me these things to collect, and then if a certain condition occurs, I will just lose them. No, that shit is not cute. It is not fun. I am not here for that. But the last level of Flower is so incredible and so sweeping and so magical and special that it was not like that. I did not, for probably 10 minutes of my life, I was playing a game wherein I did not care about the design of the game I was playing and was able to simply remove a layer of abstraction and just be playing a game and loving the experience of it.
And see, I definitely appreciate that. That's, however, the way I felt throughout the whole game.
I did not. I spent a large portion of the game, in fact, complaining like, oh man, I really wish I had an analog stick right now. And I'm not normally that guy. But if you give me a flower that has like one speed of travel and it is super fast and thus I'm missing collectibles because I have shoddy controls for moving at that speed, like, that's a problem for me, and I need more precise controls, because my brain, I cannot play that way and have fun. It wasn't until the last level, which sort of strips that context away, that I really could just let go and cut loose and be really into it. So, anyway, why don't you wrap up your thoughts on Journey, and thus, this topic?
I might just be still swept up in the experience, but it is probably one of the best games I've ever played in my life.
Would you call this Mr. Slagkick's Game of the Year?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't think there's any contest, even acknowledging the fact that there's a lot of games I haven't caught up on. I just think that I'd be very hard-pressed to find something that gave me that much of an emotional experience. And I mean, I've cried at video games before, but I mean, this I think is the first time in my life that I have been so deeply moved by a video game that it's interesting that we've talked about like the Wii U opening up a level of communication, like within, you know, the whole Together Better thing, but just the whole thing that I think Journey does is that it's almost like communicating without communicating, if that makes sense. It's just an unspoken language and camaraderie and understanding of the experience. And if you're starting the game up, it takes a while to ramp up a little bit, I have to say. At first I was like, oh, this is really cool, but it's not Flower. But then I got into it, and I'm like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
As it builds up, it's just, I mean, I'm getting a little emotional just thinking about it, so.
It's a great game. I don't blame you.
Please, if you have access to a PS3, and I just have to say, Journey alone just makes me so glad that I decided to finally just cave in and go back to PS3. I will be talking a lot more in 2013 about PS3 and hopefully my happiness with it. I'm thrilled right now, honestly.
Excellent.
So I have to just really quickly say, Sony, I'm sorry. I thought it would be like the Taylor Swift song, "We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together," but you know, let's try things again.
Excellent. It turns out, really, you were being like the Taylor Swift song.
I was being the Taylor Swift in this situation.
So, and for the record, my game of the year, Asura's Wrath.
Yes.
I played through all of the DLC, all of it. I made my partner sit down and watch me play through the entire core game.
And he was one who was not
And
really...
he was initially very against this game. You know, he makes games for a living, and he saw that it was a quick time event fest, and that it was just a story being told, and it's just like an interactive anime, and it's not really like a game. I don't know if this hype for Walking Dead had anything to do with it, but he was willing to give it a chance, so I was like, okay, cool, just watch me do the first like three chapters, and if you're not into it, I will never bring it up again. And after those three chapters, I put down the controller, and I was getting up to turn the console off, and he was like, "It's only 11. We can do a few more."
Aww.
So I ended up playing through half of the main game that night, the entire second half of the game the next night, and on the third night, I downloaded all of the DLCs, which I had been dragging my feet on for, like, 6 months. And those DLCs... one of them in particular was several hours long, and it was
kind of like this episode of the podcast.
Yeah, right. it was probably the best several hours gaming I've had this year.
That's great.
You
said you got a little emotional in your own way.
I was just gonna say, yeah, I found an emotional connection to Asura's Wrath that I didn't expect to have.
That's so cool.
I found myself cheering. The game did a really amazing breaking of the fourth wall by using its own interface elements to meta communicate with you as a player, which is one of my very favorite things. Those of you that have played Crisis Core all the way to the very end, Crisis Core did something similar with Zack in the final battle. If that's the kind of thing that Asura's Wrath does toward the end. I don't want to be more specific for fear of spoiling Crisis Core or Asura's Wrath, but I found it to be really amazing how they designed the game. One of the most visually striking battles I've ever seen, like even far and away better than like El Shaddai, which was a game, if you recall, that basically existed to be an amazing looking religious combat game. My two games of the year. First, Asura's Wrath, Journey, close behind.
And I just have a quick question about your Journey. Did you have as intense of an experience as I did with your companions?
I didn't. I had a lot of noob companions that were just clearly not understanding what the goal was, so to speak.
Okay. See, the thing is that I think that my companion must have played through before. Because I was the noob companion, and, you know, this companion was just helping me through, would give me a little boost, and I think even without that experience, it would have still been my game of the year. That said...
Well, it was, like, the only game you played this year.
Oh, fuck off.
Okay, finish your thought. You were in mid-thought, I'm sorry.
Oh, now you're going
to
let me...
I'm trying to be better about that. You had a completely valid complaint earlier.
I think that just the final thing I want to say about Journey, and I started talking about this, that they did that game company isn't trying to promote a message, but it is. I don't want to say that it's a simple game, but, you know, it doesn't really... it doesn't use dialogue. But, I mean, I still felt a very deep story, and I have my own personal meaning of what that game and the Journey means to me. For those of you who have played it, I would love to hear your thoughts. I don't want to spoil it like you've said with Asura's Wrath, you know, I don't want to spoil it. I want people to have an organic experience with that game. But I think it's just incredible that I think the comparison I made talking to someone is that like the first 40 minutes or so of WALL-E, which is one of
the good part of WALL-E.
Yeah, thank you. If they had just committed to not having a dialogue at all in that movie, I think that would be kind of the equivalent, but better.
Excellent. Excellent.
If that makes any sense.
It does. And is that all you have to say, or are you...
I think so, for now. If you'd like to discuss Journey with me, I'll be shouting out my email at the end of the episode.
Excellent.
Which will be coming soon, we promise. Thank you for sticking in.
Yep, the end is nigh. Extremely fucking nigh, as the case might be. We have for you a triple dose of Reads of the Week going out to all y'all in Radio Land today to make up for the fact that this has been sort of a really weird, long, bloated episode.
Yeah, we already kind of talked about what's up, so...
Yeah, what's up is what we just talked. Time. That's what we've been talking about, is what we played this week. Next week, we will talk about what we've played this week in, you know, a more straightforward manner. In the meantime, Kotaku has published two articles that are just awful. Penny Arcade Report has published a great article, and Kotaku, surprisingly, did knock one of them out of the park.
All right, so what time is it, Captain Spike?
Welcome to our Read of the Week. That's right, boys and girls. It is time for a read.
Shade of it all.
Kotaku actually published an article called "Yes, BioShock Infinite's cover is terrible, and yes, that actually matters." All right, so that headline, that sums up this entire fucking article. Pardon my language. It's after 1:30 now. I'm wearing out, and I don't have time for this. Kotaku basically just wrote an article, not just an article, but this is an effing essay about why it's okay to judge a book by its cover. Book, in this instance,
and
is a video
game. And I just have to say
game.
That headline is very like, oh, we're right. Yes, yes, this is something that really matters. Blah, 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 blah.
Basically, to give you the context, 2K Games revealed the box art for BioShock Infinite, and it was very, like, dude bro shootery. And a bunch of people complained, like, WTF, man, there's a ton of amazing concept art for this game. Some really cool, like, adventurous, like,
I mean,
steampunk meets
Victorian.
You think about
the BioShock 1 and 2 covers.
Yeah, which are foreboding and horrible and horrific and still, you know, very, very blockbuster looking. And Kotaku basically was just, like, insisting upon itself, like, yes, it's awful. Yes, this matters.
And insisting to you, the reader, that you should agree with them.
So we here in the Game Buoy podcast studio suggest that you look at Ben Kuchera's look at this very same issue. Because, girl, that is a read. The Art of Commerce, Why BioShock Infinite's Cover Doesn't Matter. And basically, this is... It's not a direct rebuttal to Kotaku, but it's a rebuttal to the idea that the BioShock cover art matters. And the basic idea is 2K gotta sell a game, dog. And if they can do that by putting on some dude bro art, then they should do that. Because if this is a good game, it deserves to sell. And all of us who know what the game is about, we're gonna know it's a good game. Its cover don't matter to us. If you're really butthurt about it, you can just print up a new cover at home. On a somewhat sidebar note, I feel like I read on a forum, maybe Gaff or something, that 2K Games was going to make a reversible cover to appease the whiners.
Really?
I feel like I hope they don't do that because, frankly, fucking people just need to get over it.
Yeah, what are we dealing with, Mass Effect fans?
Right? 2K gotta make a buck. We don't, you know, we want this game to be successful. If it's good, we want it to sell. And basically, 2K got to sell a game, and Dude Bro covers sell games better than interesting art projects. It sucks, but that's the world. It's a market. Next up, another one from Kotaku. This essay is titled, "Hey Square Enix, where the hell is Bravely Default?" And it's basically an open letter. "Dear Square Enix, this is getting ridiculous. It's been 2 months since Bravely Default Flying Fairy came out in Japan, where it flew off store shelves, and we have yet to hear a peep about a U.S. release. I'm not going to read the rest of it on the air. If you're really that interested in reading a bad article, you can go to Kotaku and read it yourself. We have link up on GameBuoy.org.
I'm just going to say, you could go to GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
I was like, how dare you just direct them to Kotaku?
we direct them to Kotaku through GameBuoy.org.
Via GameBuoy.org.
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 And so, this is a read, girl, because I am so effing tired of this whiny-ass rhetoric. Following a standard JRPG announcements schedule, the sort of thing that Atlus does for the Persona games, and for any of the big JRPGs, you typically have a window of like 4 to 6 months between Japanese release and American announcement. For games like Final Fantasy or Kingdom Hearts, we do typically have a smaller window because the decision has been made before the release of the game in Japan to bring it to the US because, it's a known quantity. They know it's going to sell. It's not a risk. A game like Bravely Default Flying Fairy, believe it or not, actually kind of a risk, even if just for the name. I have a sidebar for this. Please don't let me forget, Mr. Slidekick. But as Square Enix tends not to do worldwide announcements, which we do agree sucks, for these titles that are not sure bets that might lose money, so that, they release them in one territory, and then if they're overwhelmingly successful, as Bravely Default Flying Fairy has been, then, typically, after a period of time, we see an announcement for the U.S.
Is that your sidebar?
No.
Okay.
So we, I personally think we're going to see Bravely Default Flying Fairy come to the U.S. I really do. But it's really silly to complain that we haven't heard anything yet when it follows not just standard operating procedure for this company, which it absolutely does, but also, frankly, just common sense. If you don't know if a game is good enough to make money worldwide, don't put all your eggs in one basket on this game that you're not sure is going to succeed. It certainly sucks for those of us in the US. I am not benefiting from this, but if Square Enix can prevent becoming the next THQ by not putting all their eggs in one basket and rushing to market, I think we can all understand where they're coming from on that.
Yeah, there was someone who commented on this article who just was really well-informed, and they basically said the same thing, that it's been 2 months or more for Etrian Odyssey 4, which we talked about last week, Fire Emblem Awakening, and pretty much any Dragon Quest game ever made has taken more than 2 months for localization to be announced. That basically the only JRPGs that do get localization announcements within 2 months of release are the big Final Fantasy games and Paper Mario, and that even Mario and Luigi games are ones that aren't like just immediately announced. And that, basically it's unreasonable to expect anything different from Bravely Default just because all the fanboys want it.
Yeah, so, I get it. I appreciate that y'all want to play Bravely Default. I do, too. But, this kind of article, this whining, this negativity, it doesn't help on so many levels. It encourages the readership to just spout negativity about Square Enix, who's just making a good business decision. It doesn't come off well for you guys. Like, maybe it would be better if you just wrote maybe an article like 5 Reasons Why We Hope Bravely Default Flying Fairy gets announced for U.S. release. Write positive articles about why hope something happens.
Yeah, don't put this negativity out there.
This negativity, it just doesn't encourage a healthy dialogue. And frankly, it makes you guys come off sounding whiny and ill-informed.
I mean, because what's Square Enix going to think if they say, "Hey, where's our game?" They'll be like, well, maybe you won't get it. I don't think they would do that, but, you know, if...
Now, I'm going to cut you off right there.
I was just going to say that, you know...
Then I won't cut you off. Finish.
I wouldn't put it past Square Enix to snub American audiences.
No, of course I wouldn't put it past them. But again, it's not even a snub. That's to assume that the Japanese companies somehow don't want us playing their games. Like, no, if a game can make money, they're going to release it. It's really just a matter of figuring out if it's going to make money or not. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes...
But, you know, if they were on the fence and then they see all this pissiness...
Yeah,
then
well...
they might be like, well, then...
I doubt that's likely.
Because they just...
A game either does make financial sense or doesn't.
Kotaku is saying that we are entitled to Bravely Default, more or less.
And I don't agree with that. Don't get me wrong. I personally would love to play Bravely Default. I've said that several times. I'll say it several more throughout 2013. But the simple fact is, you know, I play... My primary interests in games are genres that are currently really not being... catered to. Like, I am not getting the games I want to be getting.
What a perfect segue into our final read of the week for this week.
It's, you know, it's unfortunate, but sometimes niche games can't get brought to America because people will lose money on them and will lose jobs. I do not think that my hobby of enjoying video games is worth people losing their jobs so that I can have an obscure 3DS JRPG. So, I hope this works out. I hope Square Enix can make this profitable, but if they can't, as much as it sucks, I will just have to find something else to play. So instead of being negative Nancy's about it, just reach out to Square Enix, reach out to your readership, and show your readership why this game is awesome and why we should all be positive, and maybe tweet helpfully to Square Enix, like, oh, this game looks super good. Are you guys going to release it here? Instead of being negative and awful.
Hell is it?
Exactly.
It sounds like a little, like, middle school boy.
Yeah, well, that's...
what Kotaku does best, pretty much.
That's pretty much.
But like you were saying, little niche games... aren't we just so glad that XSEED is a thing? To move on to our last read of the week.
Now, to be fair... this is another essay, and this is by the same man who wrote the article I was just being so critical of. This is by Jason Schreier. Oh, that is probably pronounced Schreier.
Schreier?
Probably, maybe Schreier. I'm not sure.
No, I'm just taking it to
I'm punch drunk. Stop being mean. And I'm going to read the headline. The Game Savers. How a tiny company gives neglected Japanese games new life in America. And, you know, it does have some of that tone of, like, oh, these neglected Japanese
games.
Well,
it's a Kotaku headline. Of course, it's a little sensationalist.
Yeah, but you know, it's actually about, you know, sort of the nitty-gritty of what XSEED does.
I really found it to be an enjoyable read.
It is a superb read. This is a read. It is superb.
And, you know,
we have talked about... you know, just in the last few weeks, about XSEED bringing over...
The Last Story.
They've done a real service to us, bringing some of these really amazing games over. And it is just great to see Kotaku giving them their due. And
even some little anecdotes, like they wanted to bring a Hatsune Miku game.
Miku!
over as a PSP Mini or something. But, you know, they just kind of recognized that there really wouldn't be a market. But one thing you automatically assumed... and you, in part, were correct, when I was talking about game companies not being fully motivated by profit, that I was just referring to that game company with Journey. But also, something that really significant that is highlighted in this read is that, you know, XSEED recognizes that these games aren't going to be blockbusters, but they are totally okay with that. They know that there's a market for these games. And we're glad that they are so passionate about finding these games that otherwise might not have had an audience over here. Well, not that... I'm sorry. Clearly there is an audience, which is why they are making these games, but that might not have had a chance of being picked up. And, you know, just... so that level of appreciation for them and, you know, it doesn't delve into... it doesn't devolve into... anything sensationalist aside from that headline a bit, And so it was just some really neat anecdotes, kind of just about kind of going into what it's like at the Xseed offices. I was really surprised that Kotaku put out something like this that wasn't even freelance. So good job, Jason Schreier. Golf clap for him.
And for the record, I know a lot of people take the golf clap to be offensive, but if I actually just clapped, the podcasting studio we record in would be very unpleasant. So
yeah.
That is a real clap represented as a golf clap.
Okay.
And with that, my dear, dear friends out in Radioland, it is time to say goodnight. As always, we here at GameBuoy Video Game Radio love hearing from you. We live for your feedback. We need your iTunes subscriptions and ratings/reviews.
We have a couple. I've seen that we have like maybe 3 ratings so far, so thanks whoever you
whoop
are.
Whoop.
I think one of them might have been me.
Lame. One was not me, so that's good. We would like your Facebook likes. And
we are on Facebook.com/GameBuoy.
Facebook.com/GameBuoy. We fucking live for Twitter. So tweet at us. I've told you our Twitter like 8 times today.
GameBuoy, D-O-T-O-R-G.
GameBuoy, D-O-T-O-R-G.
Okay, G-A-M-E-B-U-O-Y, D-O-T-O-R-G.
Yeah, I'm not repeating that one.
Okay. And
I want to shout out.
Hold on, because there's something that I think we've forgotten on the past couple episodes. You can also email us. Captain Spike is cpt.spike@gamebuoy.org.
I'm not repeating that.
And I am slagkick@gamebuoy.org. And I just was realizing that we probably haven't gotten any email because we haven't been shouting out.
I have not recently gotten show email. So you're right. You're right.
I'm exhausted. I'm ready to put it up on the side. But yeah.
I am ready to wrap it up like a burrito.
All right. So let's hear your shout outs. Same great podcasts.
Like what always. We do. You want it gayer and more Nintendo oriented? Then check out Koopa Club. They're great, and I love what they do. And of course, as ever and always, Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I blatantly steal ever so many of my cues.
I'd like to shout out to my bros at the Nerdgasm Network, the wildest group of radio video game shock jocks that you'll come across.
You know, it's funny because your show notes, it says you're going to shout out that they're typically 3 hours long. Well, tonight we beat them.
We'll see how it goes down in post-production, but we have passed the 3-hour mark recording, so hopefully we can trim it down a bit for you guys, lessen that download for you if you have crappy DSL.
Really, it ain't like they're on dial-up, girl.
Yeah, but I have crappy
anyway,
DSL.
Continue.
It's almost as bad. If you're still out there, I feel kind of shady. I'm like, if you're still playing World of Warcraft, I'm currently not, but
I think I'm going to load it up this week just for a good LOL.
If even if you don't play World of Warcraft anymore, you still like, if you're a former gamer, former player of World of Warcraft who used to play it, we love the best little horde house in Azeroth, the place for World of Warcraft news, but never too seriously, and Girls Gone Wild, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO, because even if we're not playing it, it's still probably the most successful MMO in the world. And
we don't play it. It's not successful anymore.
I'm just on a break. It's not like a Taylor. It's not a Taylor Swift situation.
I was joking. Continue.
And of course, we love Video Game Outsiders. They are the Xbox Live Community Award-winning podcast. They're just still going strong. We love what they do. We'd like to thank Zelda Reorchestrated for our new opening theme. Go support them today. There's a link on GameBuoy.org.
And with that,
thank you so much for sticking with us for this super long episode. We promise that. We can't promise, but we're going to make sure that
it is unlikely we will go this long again, but we love Mega Man, we love Journey, love the games we played in 2012,
and
we love you.
We love you, and we're looking forward to bringing you our what we do in 2013. Cheers to 2013. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I think we're going to go eat some Archer Farms hors d'oeuvres.
Stay gaming, stay thinking, have fun, and see you, Space Cowboy. And plus, you know, I pee in a skull formation out of my dick, so...
Oh, that would be so rad.
Wouldn't it?